Their whole purpose throughout history has been to teach a small number of people how to become adept at controlling everyone else and presenting their societies as desirable to the profane, so that you'll go knock on the door and say, hey, can I be a member and be initiated? With the promise of learning some great secret. What is that secret? The secret is what I have just told you this morning. The secret is how to control everybody else. And you never understand how to control everybody else until you get to the top of this pyramid of initiation. Most people never make it past the third step. All above that are carefully chosen and nurtured and taught. And Americans, for all these years, have been looking around for the enemy. They've never been able to find an enemy. So those who control them were able to control them even better by giving them an enemy. That's what Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt determined at Yalta. Who was going to be the enemy post-war? Turned out to be Stalin. And there was going to be this phony Cold War so that the population would never discover the real enemy. And I'm talking about the population of the Soviet Union as well as the rest of the world. You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the Mysteries. The very highest degrees of which combined together make up a secret order known as the Illuminati. Their goal is to destroy all existing religions save theirs, all existing governments save theirs, and shackle the mob in a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of their life, in a propagandized world to make them believe that they are happy in this system. Now, do you think they're succeeding?
Yes.
Haven't I described to you just now exactly what is going on in the world today? Yes, they're succeeding. They're succeeding because the American people don't understand their enemy. They don't even know what's happening.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. Is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers once more here at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street in Bristol, UK. In the second part, the COVID revolt. Journalists in the northwest of England, mostly NUJ members, fed up with homeworking, redundancies, AI writing their journalistic scripts and taking jobs off them, and above all, vested interests in government and censorship by their bosses. They've got together to form a pressure group, HATA, H-A-T-A, or Hold Authority to Account. I speak to the two founders, Ben Butler and Henry Widdus, and we hear a clip from the producer of the banned movie Vaxxed Del Big Tree, how Dr. Evil at Big Pharma is not helping but harming up to a third of our children for life, and how Big Pharma are getting away with it. Plus, Black History Month, how from the 1960s, Boston in the United States, a plague of gentrification meant a secret Negro removal program was rolled out across the Western world. What was behind it? And it's the pinch point between East and West. Last year, over a quarter of the population, 2 million people, were out on the streets protesting. That's Hong Kong, of course. Now, the number is zero. What with the combination of the national security law and the COVID provisions, what's life like now in the former British colony? We hear from expat Robert Hansen, who lives there. And the UN General Assembly. As that closes, we hear one of the last speeches from 2009 of the late, great Colonel Gaddafi, talking about US assassinations over the last 50 years and wars. You've heard about the Bay of Pigs and bringing in the greenback dollar as a reason to get rid of John F. Kennedy. Well, Muammar Gaddafi suggests another reason why JFK may have been assassinated. Also, we've all heard of the Grand Master of Scottish Rite Freemasons in the United States, Albert Pike. Well, quite a lot have anyway. He set up a plan for wars and revolutions to bring about world revolution. three world wars and one world totalitarian government. Webster Tarpley talks this week about his counterpart, Pike's counterpart, who formulated the plan with him from Italy, who invented the mafia, by the way, Giuseppe Mazzini. Also, the IRA kicking out the British after the First World War, the American-inspired groups behind that uprising. On that, it's the son of the chief strategist and lawyer for the US Jewish Boycott Committee of Nazi Germany in the 1930s. That was Jacob Chaikin. We hear from his son, Anton Chaikin. Anyway, Martin, this week, I suppose we should start by looking at these new COVID measures. I think maybe we can look at Scotland because it's been particularly controversial. They're basically being put on this thing called a circuit breaker for several weeks. I mean, we were told, weren't we, and Scots were told too, that this was all going to last 3 weeks back in March.
Yeah, well, I'm not quite sure what has been agreed. I think it's Glasgow that's being put on this, isn't it?
No drinking in Glasgow.
Yeah,
is that realistic?
Well, they've had no drinking in South Africa, but they're back on the grog.
Is it realistic? I mean,
what they've said is
you
pubs.
You were at Glasgow University, weren't you?
I was doing a PhD.
Yeah, so what do you think about it?
Well, I mean, the thing is that they're saying that pubs have to shut, as far as I understand, but you can still go to down the Offie and buy your bottle of Bucky. That won't stop. In South Africa, you couldn't even go to the off licence.
So this is also, it's a bizarre way to deal with a bug, isn't it?
Well, no, I mean, the idea...
No, you think it's a reasonable...
No, the point of closing down places where people are going to be in close proximity, you know, that's what happened during the actual lockdown, wasn't it? You know, the pubs were shut. The question is it justified and all the rest of it, isn't it?
What do you think?
I mean, obviously, there's been controversy this week about the 10 p.m. rule, but ultimately what's going to happen with that, as I understand, is that the Tory right, who don't like it, and others who don't like it, will vote against it this week, but the Labour Party will abstain on the grounds that they're not happy with it, but they're not quite sure whether it's a good or a bad idea, so they're just going to let the government make its mind up.
Well, that's not... really opposition?
Well, no, but they don't have to. I mean, don't forget...
They don't have to do it,
the job of the opposition in a situation like this is going to be tricky, because they've got to be constructive, and at the same time they've got to be critical.
Well, they don't oppose the right things, it seems, Keir Starmer's Labour Party. They seem to oppose the things that the government are doing that are right, and not oppose the things they're doing wrong. We've heard virtually nothing, for example, about the prosecution of Julian Assange from Starmer, have we?
Well, we haven't, because that's not in the realm of mainstream party politics.
And also,
politics.
He personally was involved in the prosecution of Julian Assange when he was DPP. So he's, in a way, an ideal controlled opposition.
Yeah, but you've got to understand that the leader of the official opposition is not there to just, come up with anything that the government doesn't like. That's not really the job. You've got to oppose, but you've also got to be constructive in some circumstances. And I don't necessarily...
In what circumstances is the Labour Party at the moment being constructive?
Well, look, what they did when Starmer was elected as leader of the Labour Party, he came to the Commons and everybody expected him to start ripping into the government. And he basically said, I'm going to support the government in what they're trying to do because it's in the national interest.
I mean, it is definitely a good idea to have an opposition that doesn't define themselves by opposing everything that a government does, but it picks its battles.
Indeed, and that's what Starmer would claim he is doing. Now, we could argue whether he's done a good or a bad job, but he's not there to just go, tisn't. That isn't, I mean, you could do that, but that's not really what you're supposed to be doing.
Anyway, before we hear from Prime Minister's questions this week, from Wednesday, let's have a listen to Thursday, where Neil Oliver was on Talk Radio talking about these measures up in Scotland. Now, he is somebody, in a way, we've seen all the barriers broken. Certainly when I was at the BBC, there was a very, very clear line between people who are current affairs faces on the TV and voices on the radio and, features producers and other sorts of presenters. Like, we've got this whole idea of Antiques Roadshow now controlling BBC's Question Time on a Thursday evening, and the same here in, on Talk Radio is going on, where you've got Neil Oliver Martin, who's a historian, who's commenting on national events. But this does seem to be that, that all those lines have gone now. The idea that you're a journalist that works on history or journalism is all out of the way. Current affairs and everything is one mishmash now.
Well, no, what's actually happened is the Tories have basically said anybody who works on the BBC in any capacity must have no political profile. Now, in actual fact, that goes in defiance of what's been standard practice, which is that, as you say, the current affairs journalists are expected to be impartial, or to an extent impartial, but the others are not.
They're basically... that's ridiculous, because we've had people like Robinson, who's the political editor, is a former chair of the Young Conservatives.
Well, indeed.
Has he got to go?
No, but the point about Robinson is, as he does, when he's doing his job for the BBC, like, and what's her name, Stratton... who's just been appointed to be Boris's spokeswoman. She used to work for Newsnight and so on. Now, she's clearly a Tory insider, but she's allowed to work for Newsnight. But while you're working for Newsnight, you're not allowed to use Newsnight as a vehicle for your views. And in fact, previously, people were allowed to do their day job, as it were, in anything, history, production, whatever, and they're allowed to have their private opinions as a private individual, just
but
as police officers.
But it depends, are they private, or are those views from an external lobby, like, for example, the globalists?
Well, I mean, basically, everybody's got their views, Tony, and some people are in the pockets of, you know, everybody's being influenced by somebody. The question is, who's allowed to speak and on what basis?
Yeah, so this could lead to a very narrow spectrum of different views being represented.
I think it's pretty clear where the Tories want to go with the BBC. They want anybody who, they say you can be an opinionated journalist, as you perhaps might be categorised, but you can't work for the BBC. The BBC has got to have people who are basically kosher, and in many ways, and I use that word advisedly, you know, they've got to stay within very definite limits. Now, that's actually not been the case historically.
But the thing
historically,
is
people have been allowed to have their
people
views.
People have their own views anyway, whether they express them or not. I think this idea of journalists being unbiased is almost an impossibility. Certainly, they should encourage all views to be represented. But we're now seeing, I think, a massive increase in people's own individual views really determining whether they get a job in journalism.
Well, that's right. And, of course, we've always known, in a sense, that's what goes on. I mean, you know, the people who make good money writing for the Daily Mail don't get right for the Daily Mail by bigging up Jeremy Corbyn, do they?
They certainly don't. And people who go on RT, like you, aren't going to do very well by dissing Vladimir Putin.
Well, no, that may be true, but I mean, in actual fact, RT are quite happy to let because it's basically on a much more shoestring basis. They're much less bothered about
it. Can I ask you? Do you ever have to tiptoe around issues, thinking, well, crikey, I can't really lay into Putin?
No. I was asked, for example, a few years ago to comment on the arrests of people in Moscow who'd just been arrested by the police. I was also asked to comment on the journalists which the police tried to fit up. And they knew what the view I was going to say, and it wasn't exactly in line with Russian government policy, but they were relaxed about it.
Yeah, and when I was on Press TV, the English language Iranian channel, which is banned in the UK, I was having a gentle go at President Rouhani there, saying that I thought he was most unwise to take a certain route. So there is a little bit of room for criticism.
Well, I mean, the problem is that for any news outlet, if you don't allow people to have their proper views, then eventually people aren't going to listen. They listen to you because they think they're going to get a variety of views.
By the way, did you just call me an opinionated journalist?
No, I just said, well, yes, but you are an opinionated.
Every journalist is an opinionated journalist.
Well, indeed, and I think the idea that you can be completely impartial is part of the, is in a sense...
It's a game.
Is a game.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if you're going to have a national broadcaster like the BBC, it's true that you've got to have a good spread of views. I think that's fair enough.
And so if people express that view, they should be sacked.
No.
Well, that's what's happening now.
In actual fact, what you should do is you should allow all reasonable views to be expressed. And I think that's what people expect.
This is a sort of lack of maturity, it seems to me. Anyway, I think I'm actually either you would call a campaigning journalist in the tradition of Richard Ingram's or Paul Foote or somebody like that, or an investigative journalist rather than just an opinionated, because I like to get to the bottom of stuff. Mm-hmm. Most of these journalists, Martin, and we're going to be doing some stuff later on, looking at the context of things like the IRA and, you know, various other stuff. For example, one of the things we're going to be looking at later is the context of David Icke. You can't just report a story on what you see that day. I think you've got to have some sort of, third dimension, which is the context. And if you don't have that, you don't really know what's going on.
Well, as you know, investigative journalism to be carried out effectively requires actually loads of resources and commitment. And, of course, Julian Assange has basically scooped everybody with what he's done over the last few years. And his reward, of course, is not to be made managing director of the BBC, is it?
No. And I doubt if we'll be hearing Neil Oliver on the BBC either, because most of their views are very pro-government. Certainly when it comes to these COVID measures, and they've had very strict rules, basically, pushing that at the BBC. So he's on talk radio, which you have to get a DAB plus radio, and you have to live in the city to listen. So it's actually quite difficult to listen to talk radio these days. They used to be on DAB, as I'm going to say a bit later on as well, at risk of repeating myself. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Neil Oliver on talk radio earlier this week, talking about the measures being taken in Scotland.
It's just another nail in the coffin, I think, for large parts of the hospitality industry up here. I mean, you don't need to hear that from me. The radio stations are full of publicans and other people from that industry laying it out in pretty cold-blooded terms about what the consequences long-term of all this are going to be. But it's just, it's so debilitating, it's so infuriating, it's so confusing. Apart from anything else, already, it's not even 24 hours since that announcement came out, and so many people have made the connection that if people can't be in pubs drinking alcohol, it will just inspire house parties, the length and breadth of the country. And if the powers that be think that's not going to happen, then they're dreaming. You know, it's absolutely inevitable that there will be an increase in the number of people who will flout the regulations, and they will meet in one another's homes. And I've mentioned to you before, the First Minister was using the word again yesterday, compliance, which puts the fear of God in me, that kind of authoritarian language, you know, that people haven't been complying.
Yeah.
You think, well, if there is, as I would predict, lots of people start meeting covertly in their homes with family, what do you do to make people comply with that? Do they then ban the sale of alcohol in all the supermarkets, or do they send out more and more people to walk up and down the streets listening out for the infuriating sounds of somebody having a good time, or even just a quiet chat with family? And in any event, this it's constantly being spun north and south of the border that it's not working because of us, that it's our fault.
Yes.
And because we're not complying. Now, in the case of First Minister Sturgeon, you know, right back at the beginning of all this, she had to get rid of her senior medical advisor, Catherine Calderwood, because Catherine Calderwood, who's a friend of the First Minister, who was laying out the message day after day about the importance of abiding by the rules, twice she went off to her holiday home. Okay?
Now, up in Fife, yeah, I remember, yeah.
Up in Fife. Now, not necessarily saying I blame her for that. I'm sure she felt she was, that nobody was going to come to any harm as a result. But in that instance, somebody that was as close to Nicola Sturgeon as that, and who was trumpeting the message on an hourly basis, didn't comply.
Right.
And now, at this end of the lockdown, there's Margaret Ferrier, the Rutherglen MP, who made two trips on a train while she had symptoms. Yeah. One of the trips after she had a positive test and knew that she had COVID, and then she went to church and sat in a congregation. That's a close personal friend of Nicola Sturgeon.
Yeah.
And if Nicola Sturgeon can't secure compliance from her closest allies, her foot soldiers who are helping her to impose the regulations, then how realistic can she be about expecting compliance from the general public? Many of whom don't like
exactly.
her
talk. And it's as Peter Hitchens said, you know, if the people who are telling us to behave cannot behave, then what is the point? I mean, the way he put it is that even they don't really believe the advice is actually any good and will make any difference.
No, the only thing, I think what is demonstrably the case is that if they lock everyone up, if everyone stays in their homes pretty much all the time, then they can significantly stop the spread, if they do it that way. And every time they relax any of that, let people out, let people go to the restaurants, open the pubs, whatever, then the numbers inevitably start to go up. So it's the case, because they don't have the vaccine and they might never have a working vaccine. The only effective tool they've got in their armory is shutting everyone in their homes forever.
Yeah.
And is that what they're constantly contemplating cycling back to? Because that is not going to work. We've said this over and over again.
Yeah.
One way or another, they have to get to the point where people are out and about, at least the people who, you know, who are not a serious risk from the COVID virus. Shield the elderly, shield the sick, and let everybody else out. But if they keep on cycling back to, oh, well, you've all got to go back to your bedrooms because you haven't been good boys and girls,
right,
then we're going to be in this on this hamster wheel until the end of time.
Well, either that or until we get a vaccine, Martin.
Yeah, or unless you live in China or New Zealand where everybody's back to work because they squashed it in the early stages. And if you get it wrong in the early stages, the options are all bad.
Or Sweden or Belarus, where no one did stop going to work.
No, indeed. They did. Indeed, you could argue that there's a different ways of approaching it. But the point is that once you've got yourself into a... I mean, we haven't got a test and trace system in this country. It came out this week that Glorious Dido Harding...
I've been filling in little forms for the last three months.
Yes,
or
I know,
so,
but
so we do have something.
Yeah, we've got something there, but at first we didn't have anything in place at all to begin with, which is why we didn't even try. And also, of course...
some would argue the test and trace is a complete waste of time because you're testing and tracing people who don't have the virus. They're just testing positive for false positives, and they're not actually vulnerable, even if they did catch it.
All right, I'm just talking about what's going on elsewhere in the world as a comparison. In New Zealand, they've managed to trace one of their community transmission viruses to an elevator button and the lid of a pedal bin.
Yeah,
that's how on top of it they are.
And the Skripal poison was traced to a door handle.
Yes, I know, but that's just bringing an extraneous thing in. Tony.
No, it isn't. I'm saying, how reliable is this information?
All right, Tony. Yeah. How reliable is any information? Any information at all, any information from you, from him, from anybody, we've got to make some judgments.
Well, one of the things that we do on this show at thisweek.org.uk is we put up links. In fact, I put up links to many of these articles so people can go and check them for themselves if you want.
Well, you can check that New Zealand. There is a link to that thing in New Zealand.
Okay.
That's how closely they're monitoring it. Now, I'm not saying that we can go back to what they've done, because we can't, because we did all the wrong things from the get-go. So now we're in a position
where we didn't know it was happening. We have this discussion. Can we
no.
just not go there, Martin, every week, don't we? The MI5 came up in... I find this clip we're about to play far, far more interesting than anything. We'll be hearing a bit from the Prime Minister's questions in a minute, which I'm afraid is becoming more and more stage-managed. But here is what the one... I call her the one that got away. She seemed like such quite a nice girl... and she's Zara Sultana, one of the Coventry Labour MPs, Martin. There were a few, weren't there, that were the Corbynites, the Corbynistas, that managed to get re-elected, and now they're being run by Starmer. He doesn't really like her. You won't hear her questions coming up at Prime Minister's questions, will you?
Well, I don't know, Tony. I don't know enough about her. I don't know what Starmer's attitude towards her is, in fact.
Well, there are Corbynites, aren't they?
Of course there are, because in actual fact, quite a lot of Corbynites were elected. But, of course, they didn't win the election under the first-past-the-post system. So
I suppose Starmer is suffering the same sort of fate that Corbyn suffered with all the Blairites that were there under Corbyn.
Well, it's inevitable under the first-past-the-post system that the party is an unwieldy beast with a left wing and a right wing.
So she talks
same with
about,
every party.
She talks about MI5 and sexual violence by the police. And he's saying effectively that the British government are trying to bring in laws to legalise this. So she's saying all these crimes that have happened that haven't been prosecuted, new legislation is coming along to actually make them legal. So this is government crimes, both in Northern Ireland and against environmental protesters, where, for example, police agents fathered children with activists that hadn't even committed a crime.
Well, the same thing's going on with the Armed Forces Bill about the foreign interventions. In other words, they're basically wanting a blank check for the military and the intelligence services to do anything they like, and it's all legal.
Well, I must
say, they've been doing pretty much what they wanted for years, but they all knew that it was basically illegal.
It might
now, of course, they will, if they get this stuff through and the Tories look as if they're going to pass it with the majority, they will be given carte blanche.
It might be biased journalism, but she's by far my favourite MP at the moment, and I think she deserves a medal for speeches like this, standing up to all of the establishment and their own party.
On the 12th of February 1989, Pat Finucane, an Irish lawyer in Belfast, sat at his kitchen table to have dinner with his wife and three children. As they ate, two gunmen burst through the door. They entered the room and shot Mr. Finucane 14 times. He was killed by a loyalist paramilitary group that then as the Prime Minister at the time, David Cameron, admitted in 2011, was acting in complicity with British security services. Far from stopping Mr. Finucane's murder, the Prime Minister described, and I quote, the shocking levels of state collusion in Mr. Finucane's murder. His family are still owed a public inquiry into the murder. Deeply troubling acts of state agents like the Finucane case are not isolated. In 2010, it came to light that for 40 years, Britain's police had run covert operations spying on thousands of civilians. More than 1,000 political groups were spied on. Overwhelmingly, it was left-wing, anti-racist and climate justice groups that were spied on, with just three far-right groups included on the list. The Sky Cops revelations have shown that police operatives deceived women into sexual relationships and that even spying on grieving families seeking justice, including the parents of Stephen Lawrence. Madam Deputy Speaker, this bill must be opposed. It places no limits on the crimes that state agents can be authorised to commit. It doesn't prohibit torture. It doesn't prohibit murder. It doesn't prohibit sexual violence. Instead, all it requires is that authorising officers themselves believe the conduct is appropriate, that is necessary by broadly defined criteria, and that it meets requirements that might be imposed by an order by the Secretary of State. Even the FBI expressly bans operatives from certain criminal conduct. But this bill doesn't ban any type of criminal conduct for British state agents. And the grounds upon which the authorisations can be granted are ill-defined and wide-ranging. Not just national security, but also, and I quote, to prevent disorder and to promote the interests of the economic well-being of the United Kingdom. This has rightly raised alarm bells from trade unions like my union, Unite, and justice campaigns like the All Grieve Truth and Justice campaign, who fear that these powers could be used to interfere with the legitimate activities of trade unions. And the bill grants these powers to a dizzying array of agencies, not just intelligence agencies and the police, but the Competition and Markets Authority, the Gambling Commission, and the Environment Agency, just to name a few. The oversight for authorisation of potentially serious crimes is scandalously weak. There are no provisions in this bill for warrants or independent judicial approval. Instead, authorisation would be granted internally. This means that incredibly serious crimes could be authorised with less oversight than what is currently required for phone tapping or police searches. And Madam Deputy Speaker, as the human rights group Reprieve have noted, survivors of the Sky Cop scandal have sought justice through the courts for abuses that they suffered. But this bill will block future claims being brought forward since it outlaws civil action against authorised activities. This is utterly unconscionable. Madam Deputy Speaker, in the bill's defence, the government claims that public authorities are bound by the Human Rights Act. And for that reason, the prohibition against crimes like torture are guarded against. But in reality, this offers no protection against agent criminality because in the government's view, the Human Rights Act does not apply to crimes committed by covert agents. As the government told the Investigatory Powers Tribunal in November 2019 in Tuscan agents, and again, I quote, the state is not the instigator of that activity and cannot be treated as somehow responsible for it. According to the government's own standards, therefore, the bill would not place any limits on the crimes agents could be authorised to commit. Not to torture, not to murder, not to sexual violence. Madam Deputy Speaker, this bill marks the latest step in a frightening descent into a growing authoritarianism coming from this government. In the past 2 weeks, it has proposed the effective decriminalisation of torture for British soldiers overseas, the shipping of asylum seekers more than 4,000 miles away to be imprisoned on Ascension Island, the ban on anti-capitalist teaching materials in schools, and now this, licensing undercover agents to commit torture, sexual violence and murder. Madam Deputy Speaker, this descent into authoritarianism should be a concern to us all. It must be resisted.
So that's the Coventry MP, Zara Sultana, Corbyn Easter, Martin, a descent into authoritarianism. She's making absolutely clear, and Keir Starmer is doing absolutely nothing to oppose this bill. In fact, there is apparently a row brewing between the remaining Corbyn faction in the Labour Party, saying that they've simply got to oppose it because this is, I mean, in fact, they've demanded, Labour activists are demanding that Keir Starmer resign after this, what is a rebellion led by her and by Corbyn. Of course, very, very little coverage of this, actually, even though it's incredibly serious, the idea that the Secret Services should be just given carte blanche to go kill and murder people.
It is. It's shocking, isn't it, that this should be brought forward. But of course, in sort of what you might call Cummings' world, they're trying to ram all this through as quickly as possible in the early stages of this new regime so that they can get, you know, because they know that later on there might be more questions asked. If Starmer isn't prepared to oppose this, that's rather shocking. I understand on the military side of the bill, of the other bill, that Starmer is saying that we're going to amend it, and therefore we are going to abstain and then try and amend the bill. I don't know whether that's a serious strategy or
it doesn't sound like one, does it? I mean, the interesting side of all of this is that if such a bill, I mean, so for example, if you've got state agents who are able to commit murder, etc., then you know, what you're then going to get is some sort of a civil war. Surely, I mean, you know, there's going to be an opposition build up in the country if and when activists are murdered. You know, maybe environmental activists can be murdered, and then there will be some sort of a civil war come out of this. Surely.
Well, that's right. I mean, basically, they've done all sorts of evil stuff.
A revolution.
All sorts of evil stuff has been done over the years by Western security services. Most people are blissfully unaware of it. They watch their James Bond films at Christmas and they think they know what goes on in that world. Or they admit to themselves they don't, and they realise that they don't know what's going on, what they don't want to know. Now, even with all this, you know, in actual fact, it's supposed to be illegal to do all these things. They've done them anyway.
Okay, so
what they're doing now is creating a scenario where anybody planning to do any of these things will know that they're going to be covered in advance.
Explaining his opposition to the security bill, Mr. Corbyn tweeted, "I have grave concerns regarding the covert human intelligence sources bill. It could enable unnecessary and unlawful interference with the legitimate activities of trade unions, environmentalists, anti-racists, lawyers," and he didn't say this, he says other campaigners, I'm saying also lawyers, MPs, political parties and journalists.
Well, that's right.
It is the inevitable temptation of the security services, Martin, is to interfere in politics, isn't it? Is to say, well, actually, here's a bill which is coming along which might challenge the security services, therefore we will either murder or destroy that campaign.
Well, that's basic. They are overmighty subjects. They're already overmighty subjects. And, no doubt it's their hand behind bringing this bill forward. It's being brought forward by the government, and no doubt it'll be some kind of whip to get it through. But in actual fact, the authors of this bill are those who are asking for complete carte blanche to carry out illegal acts. And they know these acts are illegal, otherwise they wouldn't be asking for carte blanche. If basically what they've done so far is said, we don't carry out illegal acts, and if anybody says you do, they just say we don't. But in actual fact, we know they do, and this bill, in fact, is evidence that they've known all along that what they're doing is illegal. But that's why they need this bill to cover their tracks.
The government security minister, James Brokenshire, one of the greatest surnames in the whole of politics, has claimed the bill is not the same as a licence to kill, as it would enforce rules within the scope of the European Convention on Human Rights and also within the Health and Safety Act. Now, how can you kill someone within the Health and Safety Act?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that he's mentioned the European Convention on Human Rights, because that's one of the things that the government is talking about leaving. So in other words, if the British state wants carte blanche to do anything it wants, and blimey, we've got a track record of doing all sorts of things. You know, they killed perhaps 250,000 people in Kenya in the 1950s. They orchestrated the Loyalist paramilitary campaign in Northern Ireland, which killed hundreds of people. You know, they've been involved in all sorts of stuff. They've been involved in Gladio from the get-go and elsewhere.
Why wasn't Zara Sultana one of the candidates in the Labour leadership contest? So she should be running things.
Well, no, because, Tony, it's not as simple as that, is it? you can be a candidate, but you're not necessarily going to win. And there's got, you know, basically politics seems, is the art of the possible. You might like to see her running the Labour Party, but most people have never heard of her. And therefore,
no, but with
she's
actually, with speeches like that, I think she's got a very good chance of rallying many Labour Party members.
Well,
actually,
ultimately, what should happen is, like in other European countries, there would be a Links Party, a left party like there is in Germany, and there would be a more moderate mainstream Labour Party, Starmerite Labour
Party.
Isn't
one going to be created maybe by people like Chris Williamson at some point?
No, the problem is the first-past-the-post system allows a situation where if you do that, all you do is let the other side in.
Well,
so you can't do that.
I don't necessarily agree with you. I think somebody like Chris Williamson in Derby is so well-known.
No, he stood against the Labour Party in Derby and he lost.
Yeah, but he may... And also... there are other Labour MPs who you would have thought would have won that did lose. You're right, yeah.
The only person who's ever beaten the Labour Party system is Ken Livingstone.
How?
Because he wasn't selected to
come
be
on,
the,
Ken, tell us
wasn't,
how.
He wasn't selected to be the Labour candidate for elected mayor. And it was given to Frank Dobson. And on that, because of that, Livingstone organised his own campaign against the official candidate, Frank Dobson. And he not only beat Frank Dobson in the election, Blair then had to welcome him back into the Labour Party because he didn't have any other choice. Now, he's the only person that's ever beaten that system. And you can't just imagine you're going to beat it by setting up another party. The SWP have never elected a single councillor in this country. Sinn Féin elected quite a lot of people in Northern Ireland, but then, of course, they changed the system at the point of a gun.
So let's move on to the next day, and that's Wednesday's Prime Minister's Questions. Here's Keir Starmer doing everything he can to make out that he's disagreeing with the lockdown policy, even though, of course, he really is supporting it. But anyway, here he is talking about the confusion which is reigning, which is an absolutely valid point indeed, when it comes to these local lockdowns that are now happening across the country, even though the main point to me seems to be that we don't really need to be locking down when nobody's very, very few, I keep nearly saying almost nobody is actually ill.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister can't explain why an area goes into restriction. He can't explain what the different restrictions are. He can't explain how restrictions end. This is getting ridiculous. Next week, this House will vote on whether to approve the 10pm rule. The Prime Minister knows that there are deeply held views across the country in different ways on this. One question is now screaming out, is there a scientific basis for the 10pm rule? The public deserve to know. Parliament deserves to know. If there is, why doesn't the government do itself a favour and publish it? If not, why doesn't the government review the rule? So will the Prime Minister commit to publishing the scientific basis for the 10pm rule before this House votes on it next Monday?
Mr. Speaker, the basis on which we set out the curtailment of hospitality was the basis on which he accepted it 2 weeks ago, and that is to reduce the spread of the virus, Mr. Speaker. And that is our objective. That's why we introduced the rule of six, Mr. Speaker, which again he supported only 2 weeks ago. And yet, last night they have said, and today they're withdrawing their support for other restrictions. What kind of a signal, Mr. Speaker, does this send to the people of the country about the robustness of the Labour Party and their willingness to enforce the restrictions? Mr. Speaker, that's not new leadership, that's no leadership. And we are taking the tough decisions that are necessary, imposing restrictions, which we don't want to do, Mr. Speaker, but imposing restrictions locally and nationally to fight the virus, to keep young people, keep kids in education, and keep the bulk of our economy moving. And at the same time, Mr. Speaker, we are getting on with our agenda, our lifetime skills guarantee, our green industrial revolution, by which we will take this country forward and build back better.
A green industrial revolution. Is it really going to happen, Martin? What else do you, you know, any other comments on what we heard there from Starmer and Johnson?
Well, as you know, Starmer is a lawyer. And when he says we want to see the scientific basis on which you made the decision, he knows that there is no scientific basis on which they've made the decision. It's a political decision because the Tory party are being pulled in two directions. One direction is let's close the pubs. The other direction is let's keep them open. So they've settled on let them close at 10 p.m.
I mean, it's a bit
but
like
it's a political, not
yeah,
a scientific
it's a bit like what
decision.
We have here at Bristol City Council with the increasing iron wall of secrecy around City Hall, way decisions are made. Central government, particularly with these lockdown decisions and the announcements, there's going to be more next week, apparently, they refuse to publish the evidence that's behind the decisions. Well, that tells me that they couldn't justify them if the evidence was available to the public.
Well, I think it's becoming increasingly clear to everybody, wherever they are on the political spectrum, that the decisions about this are not being driven by some kind of objective scientific analysis.
You know
analysis.
What I think is that, you know, with the very first show we did after we were booted off of BCFM by the station manager, Pat Hart, because of the restrictions from Ofcom. At least that was the reason he gave, saying effectively that they didn't want to put out harmful medical information. Well, actually, the fact of the matter is that the government information that was coming out was harmful. All the stuff about discharging people from hospitals into care homes killed possibly tens of thousands of people. But we weren't part of that. That was the official broadcasting, the official transmitters putting that sort of stuff out. What do you make of this? You know, when we were first broadcasting, I was coming back to what I was saying just then, it is the MIT article, which was, the headline was, "We're not going back to normal." So the idea being that there was going to be restrictions, you know, there would be, the restrictions would be let up a bit, then there'll be more restrictions, you know, maybe changes of policy on things like masks, and the idea of the confusion would wear people down, the point at the end of the day being that you can only get out of this if you get yourself a vaccine.
Well, there isn't a vaccine at the moment. The Russians have kind of.
What do you think about the
one.
Point I just made, Martin?
The point
about this article saying that the idea is to traumatise the public, basically to mess with people's heads and say, well, you can get out of this mess, you can get away from all this nasty stuff, you know, if you take our solution to it.
Well, since they haven't got a solution to offer, that sort of rather undermines the case you're
no,
making.
No, it doesn't. No, because they're saying that there will be a solution in the future, whether it's an ID 2020 passport that says, yes, you can start right. to get back to normal if you take the passport.
The implication of what you're saying is that there is an evil master plan behind the decision.
Well, that's effectively what that MIT article
said. Well, that may be so. All right, so there may be an evil master plan, and we can discuss it. It's to do with China.
And it may actually
be biological weaponry.
It may actually simply be to do with Big Pharma wanting to dominate the industry. As Dale Bigtree says, from a $2 billion a year industry to a $1 trillion a year industry.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about what China has said today is that if they develop a vaccine, they're contributing to the WHO's, where they will basically make the vaccine free to poor people in many countries if they develop it. So that's going to undermine Western Big Pharma. Now let's come back to the substantial point. I think Starmer is barking up the right tree here in one sense, which is it's beginning to become obvious that the government basically are making this stuff up as they go along.
In fact, through freedom...
And that is actually pretty accurate.
Through the freedom of information laws, it may be that this stuff comes out and they end up with egg on their faces.
Well, there should be a full inquiry into what happened.
That could take forever, couldn't it?
It could. It's a bit like...
Just a
bit like
freedom of information request. And that was what... And it was a legal challenge that led to the Sage minutes being published.
That's right. And it's only through having the minutes published that we realised that Dominic Cummings was sitting on the Sage Committee, even though he's a political advisor, and that would never happen before. And we would never have known that unless we'd found out through the Freedom of Information Act that he was
I
there.
I think that was actually a Freudian slip there, that we should punish the minutes, because the minutes are absolutely... what's the problem here? Anyway, look, let's just move on.
Why we didn't lock down, and that's why we're where we are now.
No, it's not why we didn't lock down, Martin. It's not why we didn't lock down. It's because we had a massive amount of virus, as you know, in March, where it was pointless locking down because it had already spread in many, many parts of the country.
Well, you've got a very decided view on all this.
Well, so have you, yeah?
No,
so
I haven't.
We did lock down in March. Let's not go there, Martin, because we've had this argument. We're boring people week after week, and you keep bringing it up. Anyway,
okay, well,
far more important, is the number of people that have been pushed into poverty by this ridiculous policy. 700,000 more are now in poverty, which may actually push over 50% of the country into poverty. That came up at Prime Minister's Questions too.
Mr. Speaker, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation have painted a very clear picture for his government. Strip the £20 universal credit away and 700,000 more people, including 300,000 children, could move into poverty. 500,000 more people could end up in severe poverty, more than 50% below the poverty line. The Resolution Foundation have called the £20 uplift a living standards lifeline for millions of families during the pandemic. Challenge Poverty Week is a moment for all of us to take unified action against poverty. The Prime Minister has an opportunity here and now. Will he do the right thing? Will he answer the question? And will we make the £20 uplift permanent?
Mr. Speaker, I don't want to, in any way to underestimate the importance of what the Honourable Gentleman is saying. It is vital that we tackle poverty in this country, and that's why this government is so proud of what we did with the National Living Wage. And what I can tell him on universal credit is that we're putting another £1.7 billion into universal credit by 2023-2024. And if that doesn't give him the answer that he wants, then he can ask again next week. But we will continue. We will continue to support people, families across this country, and we will continue to spend £95 billion a year in this country on working age welfare. But the best thing we can do for families, for people on universal credit, is to get this virus down, get our economy moving again, and get them back into well-paid, high-skilled jobs. And that's what we're going to do.
Martin, Boris Johnson, the nub of that, is refusing to roll out slashing universal credit by £1,000 per person when it comes to April. So a lot of people across the parliamentary spectrum are urging him to say, well, look, you know, people are living in abject poverty anyway. Don't cut their benefits again. This is for the lowest paid. And, of course, there are many, many that are also being cut off benefits completely. And even for those, you know, this extra £20 a week is making quite a bit of a difference when you haven't even got enough money to pay the rent.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's basically the welfare system in this country is incredibly narrow compared to comparable countries in Scandinavia, for example. I mean, that's one of the reasons in Sweden why people are quite prepared to go home and self-isolate, because they get 80% of their wages paid for by the government.
Well, we heard this week about the death of Peregrine Wursthorn, and I'm going to see if I can dig out maybe for next week some commentary on who he was. A very interesting character. Well, just quoting an article from 1995 about him, a Sir Peregrine Wursthorn of the London Sunday Telegraph called in 95 for authoritarian politics under the major government that would allow for cruel belt tightening and bitter medicines to be forced down the throats of the body politic. Do you know anything about Peregrine Wursthorn?
Yes.
This is pretty nasty stuff, isn't it?
Well, he was a member of the Monday Club and all the rest of it, and he used to edit the Telegraph, and he basically was a grind the faces of the poor man. And that's him. And of course, that is actually, you know, there in the. I mean, the Tory party could make an easy hit here by just that Rishi Sunak gave an extra £20 a week to people on universal credit while the crisis was on, as it was. But of course, they now decided that this crisis is over, so they can claw the money back. At the same time, the other side of their mouth are saying the crisis isn't over. And this is another reason why all these mayors and so on in the north of England are not happy, because if they get a lockdown imposed in their town or city, who is going to pay the furlough wages and all the rest of the people and support the businesses? So when you've got a national policy of lockdown with a national furlough policy on the top of that, so that everybody gets paid something, but if you start doing local lockdowns when there is no national money to support that, then that is going to smash the economies of the areas concerned, which is why they're all hopping mad.
Also, before we go on to another Prime Minister's question, the Scotland Yard has paid out this week to a man who was fathered by an undercover cop. This is the Spy Cops scandal I mentioned briefly earlier, Martin, and Zara Sultana, a Labour MP, also mentioned in her speech we just heard. Scotland Yard has agreed to pay substantial damages to a man fathered by an undercover officer during a secretive four-decade operation by the Metropolitan Police to infiltrate left-wing activist groups. Now that's I believe about £400,000 or £300,000 they've paid to this guy, plus an equivalent fee to his mother, and now they're bringing in a law to say, well, actually, this is perfectly legal to do this kind of thing.
Well, that's why they're bringing the law in. Can I also make the point that the money that's going to be paid to these people isn't the money of the officers who made the decision, the illegal decisions? It's our money. Yeah, it's like when people sue the health service. And if the health service is found guilty, then the general public has to pick up the tab.
Well, it's a bit like Big Pharma, isn't it, yeah, as well? In the vaccine, if you're harmed by a vaccine, the vaccine company doesn't pick up the health department.
Because they've already put that...
Our money.
They've already put that, what you might call, pre-nup into the agreement. Now, what ought to happen in banking and anything else is if you are shown to be the person that's done the illegal act, then it's your assets that should be forfeited. And in actual fact, senior officers should have been sent to prison for that, because that's the only way you deter people from criminal behaviour. If you know that as you make a decision to assassinate Pat Finucane, that 5 years down the line, you may be sent to prison for it, you might think twice before you press the button.
Okay, well, we'll make sure there's a few links to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Not only the new rules for MI5 and the police to authorise crimes, the article by Dominic Cacciani, who I seem to remember Charles Shoebridge on this programme, saying that people like him are basically the press officers for MI5. That is to say that the national media's home affairs correspondents, basically, they're on first-name terms with all the MI5 people, talking about biased journalists. Maybe they should all be sacked by the BBC, Martin.
Well, it ought to be obvious to people, you know, if you're getting information from the intelligence services, that allows you to be an intelligence journalist. But at the same time,
well, they pick and choose.
They won't pick just and give choose. That's money. Right. They won't give the information to other, to people.
But
they
then
don't
also,
want to have.
After a while, with someone like Cacciani, for example, they will feed him a few true stories, and then they'll feed him a load of nonsense, which he will then publish.
Yeah,
for the
and people have got to take on board that these intelligence services, lying is their stock in trade. They're about disinformation.
Professional liars?
Yeah, absolutely.
Psychological warfare? Psychological operations?
Indeed. I mean, the head of the Navy this week was saying, well, we've got to be really worried because as the Arctic ice melts, the Chinese, get this, will be able to send their ships around the north of Russia to attack us from the north. That's why we need more money spent on the Navy.
Also, another link
what?
I'll put up on our show page is to Kim Sengupta. This is actually from May this year, but the British Army have been called in to help quash online conspiracy theories. The 77th Brigade, which has previously been used against ISIS, has been advising the government on how to tackle claims about COVID-19 and 5G, Martin. The British Army's Information Warfare Unit is countering an alarming rise, they say, in propaganda and conspiracy theories, not from the Department for Health, Matt Hancock, but from people like us, I suppose they're saying, and experts. Like doctors, for example, Professor Dolores Carthill, on coronavirus being spread online by groups, not the coronavirus being spread, but the so-called disinformation, with increasing international links. So in a way, what they're doing is they're trying through Brigade 77 to say, well, actually, people like Tony and Martin and these critical journalists, are they're in league with foreign powers.
Well, they say that anyway. I mean, basically, they're just empire building. They want to be involved in everything. The idea that we need a secret psychological warfare unit to intervene in public debate in order to try and steer it in a certain direction. They've been doing it for years, but in a way, they're becoming more and more open about what they do. So, you know, this bill and then Brigade 77, if you imagine if you've got something like that, you ought to keep it secret. But no, it's not secret. These guys who are being paid for by the taxpayer, over 1,000 of them, I understand, all officers, so it must be costing us a pity penny. They spend their whole time going online, pretending to be people they're not, in order to spread government misinformation. That's a waste of taxpayers' money at the minimum, and it's possibly worse than that, isn't it?
Another angle to all of this is the planning system, and that's being opened up apparently by Boris Johnson and the Conservative government. The idea being that this is going to be a way to build our way out of the recession caused by COVID and by their mismanagement of the COVID pandemic. But Martin, actually, is that the case? Do you think we can do that just by relaxing planning laws? I mean, I don't know if you've been to Castle Park recently. There's an absolute monstrosity going up next to Castle Park.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the standard. That's what the developers want. They just want a green light to do that. What they want to do, which is in Castle Park case, is build luxury flats which will never house anybody who was born in Bristol, or they'll probably be going to people who live
in Hong Kong,
foreign,
maybe.
Yes, that's right. They'll be foreign billionaires and Colombian drug lords.
And the other thing is, of
who
course,
won't even live there.
People buy a bit of land. In fact, that piece of land used to be owned by the ambulance Trust. It used to be the ambulance station, didn't it? It was sold by John Savage. Not just him, obviously, but he arranged the sale to some developer, expecting that they might get a little building on it. But now they've got a multi-story building. So basically, it's a way of them multiplying their money that they were expecting to get out of the land by 10.
Well, you saw what happened with...
It's a licence to print money.
You saw what happened with that Robert Jenks, who had a meeting with Richard Desmond, and he was about to be had to pay £50 million to Hackney Council because he hadn't, you know, fulfilled what he said he was going to do. And Jenks basically illegally said, "Don't worry about it," and saved him £50 million. And he said Desmond said to Jenks, apparently at this thing, saying, "You don't want to give £50 million to these Marxists. So if you get me out of this, then, you know, that's £50 million.
Castle Park View, yeah. It's called, next to Castle Park, yeah. Here, but it's just destroying the view from Castle Park. That's why it's called Castle. Why is Marvin, the Labour mayor, so-called Labour mayor, not kicking off against this sort of abuse?
Because in actual fact, the planning regulations as they stand are basically all on the side of the developers.
But there's nothing for him, the only reason why he can't say something like, "Well, I don't actually think this is a very good thing for Bristol, as it's destroying the skyline."
Yeah, but if he did that, the developers would appeal, and on appeal, they would win.
So they've already got their planning permission.
Yes, I know, but if the council had forbidden their planning permission, they would have appealed.
I know the law, yeah, so he can get they can get the planning permission for Castle View, but there's no reason why the mayor can't say, "Well, I don't agree with this." That's what he's there for, isn't it?
Well, no, he can say, "I can't agree with this," but he can't stop them building it.
Yeah, so he's not saying anything. He's saying it's great. We've got more cranes on the horizon.
No, what he's trying to do, because of the way the Tories have set this up, they set up elected mayors, and elected mayors are going to get the business rate, which had been taken into the hands of the central government.
But we've got a mayor that thinks this kind of thing is great.
I'm just trying to explain why.
I won't bother. Let's have a listen to you. You made your attempt. Do you want to explain
again?
Well,
I'll just explain. Because what they've done, you get elected mayors who are much more accessible to developers. They again get access to the business. They cut all of the central government funding for what local councils do, but they can make up for that if they get more money through the business rate. And that means they have to get to bed with the
developers. Actually, it's interesting. We've got something.
And that's what they
do,
because that's the only way. That's the only way forward. He shouldn't be doing it, but that's what's happening.
We've got another story in the second hour or the second part of the program. A very similar sort of thing which was going on in Boston. Called Negro Removal, would you believe, in our little Black History Month section. But anyway, let's have a listen to this planning question at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
I will walk to me.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yesterday, the Prime Minister said that it would be easy to build new homes without destroying our green spaces. Now, many constituents in my part of Coventry are concerned that the government is yet again relying on dodgy figures to trample on our green spaces and build unaffordable, low-quality homes in its place. Now, as Coventry is running out of brownfield sites, precisely where does he expect these new homes to be built?
Mr. Speaker, there is abundant brownfield space across the whole of the UK, and I speak as somebody who used to be the planning authority for London, and I know whereof I speak. The opportunity is there. In many cases, the restrictions are caused by cumbersome planning procedures, but they're also caused, Mr. Speaker, by the inability of young people to get the mortgages they want and to buy the homes that they want. And that's why we are bringing forward our fixed rate mortgages for 95% of the value of the property to help young people onto the property ladder. We're going to turn generation rent into generation buy, Mr. Speaker.
Well, I mean, it's the same old from the Tories, isn't it?
They want to get people out of, like, you know, in private rented accommodation like you, Martin, to buy your own home.
Yes, but what they should be doing is providing, as we did for many decades, and it was the Conservative government in the 1950s, Harold Macmillan, that built council housing for rent. And, of course, we don't do that anymore, apart from on a minor scale.
How is Boris going to make sure that young people have got enough money to even think about buying a house, let alone putting a deposit down?
Well, in other words, yes, it's basically what's going to happen is there'll be another surge in the property market, which will free money.
Maybe if he crashes the property market.
No.
Do you think that might enable people to buy?
That's the only way that would enable people to buy. But then, of course, they can't buy because they're out of work and they can't get a mortgage. The problem, the fundamental problems with the housing market are not going to be fixed by a splurge of Barrett homes in Coventry, which will be way out of the price range of most people who need who are struggling for accommodation. But what it will do is put loads of money into the pockets of the developers, who are the main funders of the Conservative Party, and many of Conservative MPs, for example, are the landlord class. That is them. And they're lining their own pockets.
Okay, so we had the virtual Conservative Party conference. These virtual, do you think it's missing something, the Labour and the Conservative conferences, Martin, without the sort of big round of applause at the end, the cheering and the screams from the audience?
The official conferences were becoming very stage managed anyway, but of course, once you do it online, it really is stage managed. There's nothing else to do.
Isn't the Labour Party conference actually a little bit different from the Conservative Party conference, where they have votes and things like this?
What happened during the Blair era is they basically made the party conference into a rally, and the decisions were no longer made by party conference; they were made by other.
That would be an interesting idea, wouldn't it? Having
means.
A political party which actually made decisions at a conference through debate.
Well, that was what used to happen, and of course what it led to was huge bare knuckle fights at the Labour Party conference.
When you say bare knuckle fights, do you mean heated debate?
Heated debate, but it also, don't forget, if you're trying to win an election, you don't want to be, I mean, it's all very well to make your policy in public, but then everybody can see how sausages are made and it turns them off. That's why everybody kind of agreed to make sausages first and then cook them nicely and then present them.
Was that the right decision?
Well, I think there's pros and cons to both ways of doing it, isn't there? I mean, it's nice for people to see how the sausages are made, but then it leads to a situation where people are turned off politics. They think it's just a load of rally.
Surely that just means that you've got a bad chairman if you're allowing people to have really nasty fights in a conference.
The problem is that
some good chairing, and actually you can make sure that the people who are stepping over the line aren't allowed to contribute to a debate.
But more than that, it's more to do with what the policy is going to be. And don't forget, at Labour Party conference in the bad old days, or good old days, however you want to call them, the union bloc vote was one third at least of how things were decided.
But it's becoming a fix-up. Like all political parties, a fix-up behind the scenes.
Well, don't forget, political parties are not actually obliged to be democratic. The Democratic and Republican parties in the US.
No, but surely more people are likely to join a party if they feel they've got a say in the policy.
Yeah, but at the same time, that's a rather modern idea.
It's just Jeremy Corbyn's idea.
It's a modern idea that it comes from the US in the 1960s, actually.
That's surely why Jeremy Corbyn did so well and brought such a lot of new people in, because he was opening these debates up.
Yes, and of course the point is that everybody's got the idea now, they think they've learned it in school, that political parties have got to be internally democratic. There's no rule that says that. None whatsoever. Look at the Brexit Party run by Farage. That's basically, it wasn't a political party. It was a crowdfunded thing set up by Farage.
My point
still
stands.
There was no internal democracy.
A democratic party is much more likely to get people to join it because they feel they have a say in the way it goes.
Well, I would suggest that Farage shows the opposite. He managed to, without having a
political
party.
Because none of the other parties were serious about Brexit.
Well, okay, but the point I'm...
It was a single issue party.
Yeah, yes, it was a single issue party, but it was allowed to function. It wasn't internally democratic, and it did quite well. This is just an objective
analysis.
Yeah,
you sound to me like you don't like the idea of the Labour Party actually being democratic.
No, I don't. I'm just trying to. All I'm trying to do is I'm trying to let's unpick the factual matters that need to be unpicked.
But if you did do it, surely you would attract support.
Well, yes. Or alternatively, you might drive people away because it looks like you're a swivel-eyed minority, and you haven't taken account.
Decisions are, they need to be properly chaired, is all I'd say. Right, Boris Johnson, here he is at the virtual Conservative Party conference in his big speech this week.
When COVID struck, there were millions of people, often young people, who found themselves locked down in rented accommodation, without private space, without a garden, forced to use ironing boards for desks and bedrooms for offices. And I know that there are many people who are, of course, very happy with renting, the flexibility that it offers. But for most people, it is still true that the overwhelming instinct is to buy. And many of them simply can't, not because they can't afford the mortgage, but because they can't afford the deposit. And the disgraceful truth is that levels of owner occupation for the under 40s have plummeted in this country, and millions of people are forced to pay through the nose to rent a home they can't truly love or make their own, because they can't add a knob or a knocker to the front door, and in some cases they can't even hang a picture, let alone pass it on to their children. Yes, we will transform the sclerotic planning system. We will make it faster and easier to build beautiful new homes without destroying the green belt or desecrating our countryside. But these reforms will take time, and they're not enough on their own. We need now to take forward one of the key proposals of our manifesto of 2019, giving young first-time buyers the chance to take out a long-term fixed-rate mortgage of up to 95% of the value of the home, vastly reducing the size of the deposit, and giving the chance of home ownership and all the joy and the pride that goes with it to millions who currently feel excluded. We believe that this policy could create 2 million more owner-occupiers, the biggest expansion of home ownership since the 1980s. We will help turn generation rent into generation buy. We will fix the long-term problems of this country, not by endlessly expanding the state, but by giving power back to people, the fundamental life-affirming power of home ownership, the power to decide what colour to paint your own front door. With our long-term fixed-rate mortgages, we want to spread that opportunity to every part of the country. And that is the difference between us Conservatives and the Labour opposition. They may have million-pound homes in North London, but they deeply dislike home ownership for anyone else. We want to level up. They want to level down. We're proud of this country's culture and history and traditions. They literally want to pull statues down, to rewrite the history of our country, to edit our national CV, to make it look more politically correct. We aren't embarrassed to sing old songs about how Britannia rules the waves. In fact, we're even making sense of it with a concerted national shipbuilding strategy that will bring jobs to every part of the UK, especially in Scotland. And we believe passionately in our wonderful union, our United Kingdom, while the Labour opposition have done, frankly, nothing to defend the union and continue to flirt with those who would tear our country apart. And I say frankly to those separatist Scottish nationalists who would like this country to be distracted and divided by yet more constitutional wrangling, now is the time to pull together and build back better in every part of the United Kingdom.
So, there's Boris. What do you make of him, Martin?
Well, there's a bit of a ragbag in that. You know,
he's stressing this whole thing of the home-owning democracy, isn't he?
Yes, and of course, the fundamental flaw in all of that is that all of these people who are going to get this subsidised housing, basically, because the free market operates in such a way that these people can't afford to get a to buy a house. He is saying that the government would intervene to make it possible for them to buy a house. What could happen if there's a property market crash is they end up in negative equity, so that's the problem for them. But don't forget that the rest of the poorest third of the population, who will never own a house, are paying taxes on their PAYE so that these people can get a handout from the government to buy a house. That's not free market economics. That's crony capitalism.
But isn't he, the idea is he's holding out this sort of fig leaf, saying, look, vote for us and we'll get you a home of your own.
Yes, and it's definitely geared towards younger voters in the swing constituencies under our first-past-the-post system. He's offering them free money. But the free money he's offering them is the money paid in taxes by those who will never own their own homes. Why should they think that's good? They don't. I don't.
Anyway, so let's have a listen to the real leader of the Conservative Party, Rishi Sunak. He seems to be really calling the shots. He's an interesting character, Martin, isn't he? Former Goldman Sachs, surprise, surprise. Does seem like Goldman Sachs is in the driving seat in many, many of the European economies, actually.
Well, he's definitely a hedge fund boy from the inside. He was head boy at Winchester. And, of course, his family originally came from Uganda. And if Enoch Powell had his way, then they wouldn't be here.
What about Goldman Sachs, though?
Well, what about them? The vampire squid on humanity.
But, isn't,
but they've been overtaken by BlackRock.
That's right. Apparently BlackRock is the new, you know, they have out Goldman Sachs to Goldmine Sachs.
Yes, indeed. So, well, I mean, the point is Goldman
Sachs. Who are these people and what is their role?
What happened at Goldman Sachs was really interesting. I won't go on. But, I mean, they basically were a hedge fund and they were turned into a bank overnight in 2008 so that they could be bailed out. Because, of course, the rules at that stage said you can't bail them out if they're not a bank, because banks were regulated. Goldman Sachs were not regulated. They were a hedge fund. But they were turned into a bank and therefore bailed out as a bank. And, of course, they're now at they and others are at the heart of the financial system,
I think,
which denies
Boris,
people mortgages that Boris is going on
one
about.
One thing Boris has got going for him is he does come across as reasonably convincing and genuine, even if he isn't. But Rishi Sunak doesn't really come across, I think, very well at all. He comes across as a rather creepy banker, even though what he's doing and saying is apparently popular amongst the public. I wonder, because he just comes across as a bit of a funny guy, you know. Anyway, if you think that you believe him, or is he just, I mean, does he believe this stuff, or is he just reading a speech? Because I've listened to the real leader of the Conservatives, at least certainly sitting in the sidelines, Rishi Sunak, at the virtual Conservative Party Conference 2020 now.
Our Kickstart scheme will help hundreds of thousands of young people into good quality work, and we will help small businesses adapt. That's why we've delivered government-backed loans, tax deferrals and tax cuts. In a free market economy, it is the entrepreneur who is critical. And we will make it easier for those with the ambition and appetite to take risks and be bold, to do what they do best and create jobs and growth. And we will protect the public finances. Over the medium term, getting our borrowing and debt back under control. We have a sacred responsibility to future generations to leave the public finances strong. And through careful management of our economy, this Conservative government will always balance the books. If instead we argue there is no limit on what we can spend, that we can simply borrow our way out of any hole, what is the point in us? I have never pretended there is some easy, cost-free answer. Hard choices are everywhere. I won't stop trying to find ways to support people and businesses. I will always be pragmatic. The Winter Economy Plan, announced only 2 weeks ago, is but the latest stage of our planned economic response. I will keep listening, keep striving to be creative in response to the challenges our economy faces, and where I can, I will act. I will not give up, no matter how difficult it is. The British people and British businesses won't give up.
Rishi Sunak, Prime Minister in waiting there. Dave, our sound engineer, has pointed out he did sound rather like Tony Blair or maybe David Miliband, Martin. He did sound definitely as if he was reading it out. He certainly wasn't speaking from the heart.
Well, what's interesting about what he's done is what they should be doing is saying we'll do whatever it takes to keep the economy going through this next period. And of course, he's been popular because he's handed out lots of free money, you know, free meals for people who can afford meals.
He's saying things like, I won't stop trying to help people. But how many people have actually received this money?
Well, at the same time, he's saying we're not destroying small businesses. We're not stopping trying to help people, but we're going to cut £20 off your universal credit. Now, in other words, they're going to face a problem like Osborne faced, which is that if they start cutting back as they claim they want to do, then the economy is going to start going down. All you can do at this stage is print money.
This is a political attack, really, on small businesses and the poor, surely. I mean, that's the actual effect of what his policies have done. Because if you look at the people who've been helped by all these big government handouts, they are those with the powerful lawyers who've managed to stay open against the wishes of the government, big chains and people like this, big warehouses, these sorts of places, and the small to medium-sized businesses have been, you know, massacred by all this.
Well, you've got to recognise that Sunak and Cummings, they're the two poles of power, are not necessarily on the same page. Sunak has actually made quite a lot of political capital out of going out and carrying out an essentially Keynesian policy. That is to say, we're going to, basically, the government is going to borrow money and spend money to keep people stable in their situations, whatever they are. And that was quite popular. And even quite conservative people, especially if they're getting a bailout, have been quite happy to be bailed out. He's now reverting to more Tory type, saying, yes, but we can't really afford all this. And of course, the problem for him and for the whole government is that unless you keep spending going into the economy starts to go down the drain. So if you look at today's figures, they expected a 5% jump in GDP over August, and it's less than half that, which means that, in other words, the economy jumped back after the lockdown was lifted, but it didn't jump back very high, and it's now starting to slide back down again. Now, that's partly to do with more lockdown coming, possibly, but it's also to do with the fact that at this stage of the game, if you cut back public expenditure too much, the economy goes down faster, which is exactly what Osborne discovered when he lost the country's AAA credit rating through too much austerity. But the Tories don't believe there is such a thing as too much austerity. But at the same time, they're all having heebie-jeebies, because if they're not bailed out, they're going to go bankrupt.
Well, certainly Peregrine Worsthorn... Sorry, Sir Peregrine Worsthorn didn't. Okay, so this week, one of the quite big sensations has been... It got the front page of the Mail, was this thing called the Barrington Declaration, where various epidemiologists and doctors got together over in the United States and made a declaration saying that they believed that herd immunity was the only really real way to cover COVID-19. One of those doctors involved in that was Dr. Jay Bhattacharya. She's from Oxford University, and she had this to say this week.
In any event, that we will be relying on a combination of vaccination and naturally acquired immunity to provide the level of protection we really want. The two other points I wanted to make was that this business of protecting the vulnerables in some ways is just a subset of total lockdown. And we've certainly endured total lockdown and implemented it. And, you know, some people would certainly say it was successful. So I think that one could view it in that sense as just a subset of what we've already done. And also just to remember that it would be a temporary measure. So I think a lot of the criticism is kind of predicated on it being a kind of permanent state of affairs. And of course, that's not what we're advocating. We're saying, let's just do this for the 3 months that it takes for the pathogen to sweep through the population, create enough herd immunity. You know, it's a sort of fundamental feature of a pathogen that has the kind of infectious period that this SARS-CoV-2 has, and the R0 that it has, that it should rise, peak, and drop off within that period. I think almost all mathematical modellers would agree to that, and indeed that is what we've observed in many countries where it has kind of ripped through. So, I mean, I would be confident in saying that if we adopted this strategy, then maybe we could all have a very nice, normal Christmas.
So she's talking really here about the kind of bell curve, Martin, that sort of goes up and it goes down. This is part of standard deviation statistics. She said that's basically finished in July. And if you actually, I'll put a link up on our show page to the NHS figures, and you will see whilst there are quite a lot of positive tests out there, quite how reliable they are is not really known. The actual number of deaths is virtually zero, and it has been since July.
Okay, well, all I'll say about this is they are openly, and they've been quite clear about this, we should go for a herd immunity strategy. That's what Cummings thought at Sage last March. But then they panicked and they said, no, we're not going to go for a herd immunity strategy. But Boris Johnson even talked about a herd immunity strategy on the TV and then backtracked and said, oh, we never even discussed that.
Yeah, that was when we had Neil Ferguson and his rather scary model.
I'm just going to talk about the politics of this. Now, it's going to be very difficult to turn round at this stage and say, you know, we had all this lockdown and everybody couldn't see their relatives and even when they were dying and so on. And we did it so we could avoid a herd immunity strategy. Do you know what we're going to do now? We're going to go have a herd immunity strategy.
Well, they're not. They're carrying on the lockdowns, Mark.
Well, no, they're in other words, they're not going for a herd immunity strategy. And don't forget that these people, whoever they are not speaking on behalf of the whole of their profession. I sent you Nafis Ahmed's analysis of who these people actually are this week. I don't know if you read it. They're very many of them are linked to right-wing think tanks. There's actually economists involved who've got nothing to do with anything to do with epidemiology or medical science at all. And many of them are actually consultants to the Tory government, and they're actually in the loop. So there's definitely push coming
but they
inside.
They're better qualified than Nafis Ahmed medicine, aren't they?
Well, yeah, but Nafis Ahmed pointed out the economists certainly aren't. They're economists. And I certainly argue with the economists till the cows come.
Well, this group is of doctors, not economists. Yeah,
it's a mixed group.
So there are three. Okay, I'll put a link up on our show page to the three doctors
and put
who
up
are giving,
Nafis Ahmed's
who are giving
stuff
the statement.
As well.
And we'll put up Nafis Ahmed's statement too, of course, because we do like to do a broad spread of opinion here. But anyway, I thought what they were saying it's extremely important and very interesting that they've said that actually, you know, basically you can't do a King Canute and tell the virus to go away, a bit like Neil Oliver was saying.
Politically, they've got to, if the government's going to do that, they've got to say we're going for herd immunity.
Anyway,
and
so
they've got to explain why we didn't do it to begin with.
Lots of doctors haven't been heard. Those ones now have. Another doctor that is rarely gets any kind of airing on the mainstream press at all is Dr. Vernon Coleman, who's moved now onto brand new Tube after being censored from YouTube. He's the author of an absolutely wonderful book, which I came across in the mid-90s, called How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You. And he's talking about censored experts and strategic lies.
Professor Ioannidis of Stanford described COVID-19 as a widespread and mild disease comparable to influenza. Also of Stanford, Professor Atlas described COVID-19 as generally mild and said there was no reason for extensive testing. Dr. Chris Whitty, the British Chief Medical Officer, remember him? Originally said that COVID-19 posed no danger to the vast majority and said that most people don't fall ill or only mildly, and that those who are seriously ill have a good chance of recovery. I wonder why he changed his mind. Professor Carol Sikora said that fear will kill a lot more people than the virus. Professor Lass, former Director General of Israel's Ministry of Health, said that the lockdown measures had been totally disproportionate and a threat to hundreds of millions. Professor Gupta of Oxford University argued that COVID-19 was likely to result in a death rate of less than 0.1%, a flu-level danger. Leading German virologist Professor Streeck criticised the use of masks, which he said were a wonderful breeding ground for bacteria and fungi, and criticised the lockdowns. A leaked German ministry paper described COVID-19 as a global false alarm. Professor Pershall of Hamburg has emphasised that the danger of COVID-19 has been too much influenced by media messages and that COVID-19 is not a killer. He pointed out that a lockdown was exactly the wrong thing to do, since the lack of exercise can cause thrombosis. Indeed, blood clots have been a major problem among both those with and without the virus. And so on and so on. Literally hundreds of experts have said the same thing. COVID-19 is not a major threat, and the actions taken have been inappropriate, disproportionate, and dangerous. Dr. Mike Yeadon, former chief scientific advisor to Pfizer, a drug company, is reported as saying that, quote, there is no science to suggest a second wave should happen, close quotes. He allegedly said that half or even almost all tests for COVID are false positives, and he concluded that any second wave of COVID and any government case for lockdowns will be entirely manufactured. Next, it said that immunity in people who've had COVID-19 is short-lived, and that people who've had the disease can catch it again. This argument's been used by those who believe that vaccines need to be given repeatedly. This, to me, rather bizarre idea seems to have been based on the claim that 290 people in South Korea appear to have caught the disease twice. However, all 290 were false positive tests caused by non-infectious virus fragments.
So that's Dr. Vernon Coleman there, and his little channel. He's always very polite at the end. Says, thank you for listening to an old man in a chair. He's really, for me, one of the superstars of the pandemic, if it is a pandemic, which is very much questionable. And I'll put a link up to that on our show page, where he there is talking about strategic lies. Of course, the idea is that you look at the potential flaws in your argument and you make up strategic lies in order to cover them. So, for example, the idea that, oh, well, I've, you know, had COVID-19, now I'm immune, a strategic lie might be, oh, you can catch it two, three times. You can catch it many times. You can't get immune to this. And that in order to sort of push the fear factor when it comes to the virus. Anyway, I'm joined by Ian Robinson now from Avonmouth. Hi, Ian.
Hi, Tony.
Thanks ever so much for coming in, Ian. First of all, reason I asked you down was because on Monday I got caught up in a horrible cloud of smoke. Actually, it was quite a low, cloudy day, and it was quite a misty day anyway. But this low cloud of mist we had in North Bristol on Monday was tinged with a horrible smell.
Yeah, that would have been from the Sims Metal Management fire at Avonmouth Docks. It started at 10:30 on the Sunday night and burnt all the way through the night, all the way through Monday, and was basically damped down and put out by Tuesday.
Okay, so the fire brigade, or actually we've got to call them Avon Fire and Rescue. I was that had that drilled into me when I was doing PR for them.
Okay.
You're not allowed to call them a fire brigade. They did a good job in putting it out, but I was very surprised at some of the tweets they put out about it. First of all, they didn't say where the location was, until it was circulated by others, by local residents, probably like yourself. I'm not sure if you did that. But 20,000 tons of scrap metal, they said, was on fire. Now, I pointed out to them on Twitter, look, scrap metal doesn't burn. So what is this that's burning?
Well, this is correct. You know, I had an issue with the station manager who stated it was clean scrap metal that was burning. The way the Sims site works is you've got a big smashing hammer, for want of a better word. They take broken cars in, lorries, etc., and they shred that metal. But they don't take the seats out. They don't take the petrol tanks out. They don't empty the oil, etc., or they should do before it's brought in. It should be depolluted before it's brought in and atomized. It then gets picked up off the end of the conveyor belt and stuck on the side of the wharf, ready for loading. And that's where the 20,000 tons were. So it wasn't just clean scrap metal.
So this was going to be loaded onto something, but then it wasn't. We've had a bit of a history with Avonmouth, haven't we? Massive amounts of scrap of various sorts accumulating to be sent abroad. And then, for example, the Malaysians then refused to take it. There was a whole load of plastic that was going to head for Malaysia and a deal done to take it to Malaysia. And then the Malaysians said no. Well, there was a change of government, actually, to a much less corrupt government in Malaysia, where they're now doing the 1MDB scandal and prosecuting the previous president for being involved in that scandal. And Malaysia has got rid of its corrupt politicians. They no longer wanted to take the plastic. So one does suspect if something similar is going on here, that this is very expensive to get rid of this waste.
Well, the scrap metal is not waste. It's bought all over the world. It's, you know, sent to China, India, etc. It goes into big slag furnaces and all the nasties are burnt out. And then what's left is basically...
So this was quite valuable, was it?
Yeah, oh yeah. It's a very, very big market. Sims basically doubled the size of their operation back in 2018-2019 after having secret meetings with our local councillors Joe Sargent. They had a meeting. It's up on my FOI request that no notes were taken in contravention to the Nolan Principles of Public Life. And then shortly afterwards, they managed to push through a planning application to double the size of their tonnage that they could put through per year.
He's the chair of the planning committee, I think, Don Alexander, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Sits on two merchant venture boards as well, the Docks Committee, the Docks Benevolent Fund and the Downs Committee.
Okay, the merchant venturers rear their ugly head again, the slave traders, Black History Month, although it seems that the current inheritors of the slave trade and the discovery of North America by John Cabot, the genocide, etc., don't like to get, you know, much coverage of their, in fact, very few local journalists really cover anything much to do with the merchant ventures. But they're heavily invested in the port, Ian, aren't they?
Absolutely, they're owners. Two of them are owners.
In fact, they were the port. The rest of the port, the lease or the freehold, was handed over for rather a small sum, some would say, by the former member of the Merchant Venturers and Bristol's independent mayor, George Ferguson. He handed that over when he was mayor a few years ago, didn't he? So, Auden Mordant, who are these people?
Two merchant venturers. They own the port, basically. I think it's Terence Mordaunt and Jonathan Ord, or it could be the other way around, I don't know which one they are.
The idea is they were also talking about having some sort of deep water port there. Is there still talk about that? Do you know?
It will happen at some point.
Financed by China?
I believe so, yeah. I think that's probably why it's not happened at this point, is a lot of the money dried up recently. And they haven't managed to build it yet, but it's 12 hours close to steaming, so it's a done deal.
One wonders also about the Chinese money for Hinkley Point too, whether that's going to arrive. With this fire particularly, it was absolutely an enormous fire burning for about 18 hours and an enormous great plume of smoke that went right across. In fact, you could see it. They see it from Wales. I had heard reports from Stroud in the local paper there, saw reports online that people could smell this in Stroud. And it certainly, I think the main issue here is the Avon Fire and Rescue were playing down the toxicity of this. I mean, it seems to me as if what was burning, just from the smell of it, was extremely toxic. If you set fire to something, pour some a petrol, say, on some plastic and set fire to it, that's the kind of smell you got. It certainly didn't smell like burning steel, which actually steel doesn't burn anyway.
No, indeed. As I say, you know, they don't take the seats out, so there's formaldehyde and fire retardants in the foam of the seats and the fabrics. You've got all of the wire and looms, all the plastic on the wire, all of the wire itself and the acids that are placed on wire to make them fire retardant, etc. There's a lot of real nasties in there, and you're right, the fire brigade or fire and rescue service were extremely playing it down. They didn't want anybody to know. The only reason they tweeted out at 5 a.m. that there was a fire is because you couldn't deny it anymore. You could see it.
Yeah, and people basically driving along the M5 were finding that they were going through a very, very thick cloud of smoke and couldn't hardly see the car in front of them.
Yeah, and there was a warning put out for the people on the motorway.
I would say they should close the motorway in that sort of circumstances.
Absolutely. And the thing is, they got very, very lucky. There was a major fire in 2019, it seems. I believe it was 40,000 tonnes at that point that they were battling the fire for. It didn't burn as long, luckily. Last week they got extremely lucky because that plume of smoke, if we'd have had a calm day, that would have just hung in Avonmouth and you would have had people dying like you did in Bow Pass.
So how does a pile of scrap spontaneously catch fire on Sunday night?
Well, this we've yet to see, you know, the Jack and Ori version from Avon and Fire Rescue Service as to what actually happened. My theory would be that on a Sunday night they're rushing to get the pile built to transfer to a ship coming in, and they hadn't depolluted several cars quite probably, and they've been smashed up by the rolling hammers. That generates a lot of heat, and the thing is, you've got not just petrol if they haven't taken out, but you've got greases, etc. Yeah. That are sliding.
Do they
down.
Have car batteries in there too, and electrical stuff?
Well, one would assume that they should have actually taken this out as part of the depolluting process.
Part of the problem at the port is there's no access whatsoever. No one can check on anything in there, can they?
That's correct. Yeah.
Is there any way to make it so that it's a little bit more public, that people feel that they can't just do anything they want without anyone knowing, or even the, you know, with the authorities of whatever sorts?
Well, the loading operation is governed by Bristol City Council. The fragmentation operation is governed by the EA. Both should have plans in place. There should be regular fire reviews and fire plans that are in conjunction with Avon Fire and Rescue Service. This obviously hasn't worked because we've had two major fires in 2 years.
What about the flies? That was one of the big problems you had down at Avonmouth back in 2011 and 2018. Major problems. Basically fly infestations. You know, this is the sort of thing, I suppose, which was based around rubbish being left there of various rather murky, nasty sorts of flies were breeding in here.
Yeah, this was New Earth Solutions. Obviously, Bristol City Council denied this because they are a customer of theirs, as are Sims Metal Management. Now, when the contract was transferred to Viridor, which is still running late, I believe, so it's going to Suez currently. All of the waste was removed from New Earth Solutions, and then magically, within about 4 days, 5 days, the situation improved dramatically.
Well, that's really good news, because it just sounds like the most horrid thing you could possibly have to endure as a resident of Avonmouth.
Lawrence Weston, Shirehampton, Sea Mills, Hallen, Severn Beach. It wasn't just Lawrence Weston, it was spreading further and further.
Okay, so what other places are there that are of concern to residents?
We've got what was Earth Minded. I believe they've changed their name again. They recycle steel drums for the chemical industry. And you may have seen a story in the Evening Post a couple of years back where red smoke was spotted coming out of one of the stacks. Eventually, the Environment Agency had to admit that there wasn't a management plan on site that was being followed, and they couldn't identify the chemicals for a number of weeks, and it turned out to be medical iodine, which is radioactive.
Oh, lovely.
You know, so and being as you could see the smoke, they hadn't been taking the temperature of the stack up to 800 degrees, so that wasn't being burnt correctly.
Oh, dear. So, I mean, you know, this is basically out of sight, out of mind, isn't it? That's what seems to be going on at Avonmouth. You stick all the most horrible industries down there, and no one is really properly keeping an eye on them. One of the things I have seen, though, is these, I suppose they're dustbin carts of Suez, the Suez incinerator.
On the train.
Well, actually, no, driving around in the city here.
Yeah. They've got a big incinerator in Avonmouth. Viridor have got a big incinerator in Avonmouth, which is just being completed. Suez gets six North London boroughs, including Kensington, Chelsea, etc., send 110,000 tonnes of waste to Bristol every year to burn, and they're going to be bringing in another 100,000.
Are they generating power from it? That's what they say.
Allegedly, yeah.
Well, why do you say allegedly?
Well, that's what the energy from waste industry is supposedly all about, is diverting stuff from landfill, which is the key driver behind it. Under the European Waste Directive, every year the cost of landfill goes up and up and up for local councils. So the way they
have to burn it, basically.
Well,
or do something with it.
Well, they should do it in their own backyard, really. You know, that's what European
Waste Directive
is.
The interesting thing is, of course, this is all just upwind of us here in Bristol. So pretty much, unless you've got a northerly wind, which I think we've got like these couple of days, the wind is blowing, which I suppose it will blow straight down to Taunton or something from Avonmouth. Yeah. Most of the time, this muck is blowing straight towards Bristol. Now, we've got this sort of the mayor, Marvin Rees, the so-called Labour mayor, is getting very irate about diesel fumes in the city, but he doesn't seem to mind about all this muck coming from Avonmouth and blowing straight over us here.
Exactly. There's nearly 2 million tonnes of waste incinerated in Avonmouth every year. Yeah, and it's not even counted or figured in the Clean Air Plan or even measured.
Amazing. Anyway, look, Ian Robertson, would you just like to plug any, you know, sort of social media you've got or websites people can find out more about your work down in Avonmouth? I think of you as our Avonmouth correspondent, actually.
Yeah, you could check out the Avonmouth Community Action Group. Send a request, we'll admit you. We try and keep an eye on things and get information out to people. Unfortunately, the Severnside sirens, Tony, before I can go, if I may, didn't go off. Now, they're supposedly for coma sites, and we've been pushing for sites like Sims and New Earth and any of these nasties that are in Avonmouth to be added to the coma designation.
Coma?
I believe it's certificate of is major chemicals and etc. Now, the Severnside sirens were put in after the acid plant exploded a few years ago in Avonmouth. Those should have been utilised to warn residents. And interestingly,
I mean, I would have thought they should have gone off for this Sims Metal management fire on Sunday night.
Well, we've been pushing for that to happen, you know.
Why didn't they?
Well, because they're not a coma site as far as Avon and Somerset Police and the Severnside sirens.
They're trying to say it's not toxic.
Yeah, exactly. And
they don't want to frighten people. They don't want to know. They don't want attention to it. This is the problem.
Well, it's not frightening people so much. I think they just want to cover it up when it goes wrong.
I mean, when people smell that stink coming into their house, of course they're going to shut their windows. And so this is just, to me, it's just an appalling incompetence, mismanagement and fear-mongering by people who are supposed to be looking after us. Anyway, Ian Robinson, thanks very much for joining us. I'm going to carry on by talking a bit about the since we're on a kind of Bristol Channel theme here, just over the other side, we've got a police force called the South Wales Police, are one of the most corrupt in the country. I think it's very fair to say that. We've had many reports on their treatment of the flying vet, Maurice Kirk, after he evicted a drug dealer who was the son of a police superintendent in South Wales Police, and he was harassed by that force and is still being harassed by South Wales Police to this day. I'm not sure quite how he's getting on. We should have a report from him, as we usually do every few months, to see how Morris is faring. But it gets much worse than that. And back in 1999, the Clydach murders, the South Wales Police were absolutely appalling, and it turned out that it was almost certain, and we can't say it was, but it was almost certain that one of their officers was responsible for the murder, and then they fitted various people up. But anyway, let's have a listen now to a short clip from an excellent BBC Panorama, back in the days when Panorama was worth watching, about South Wales Police corruption.
In the past, South Wales Police officers have secured murder convictions by fabricating such evidence. Mike O'Brien, released from prison after serving 11 years for a murder he did not commit.
It came as a shock, Phil, did. I didn't expect it.
Oh, okay.
I had already Christmas dinner sorted out with the lads on the wing, as it happens. Yeah, roast beef and everything.
Mike O'Brien has spent much of his time since his release pursuing a legal action against South Wales Police for malicious prosecution. He alleges that his imprisonment was no accident. Police officers, he says, fabricated the evidence against him. The police are fighting the case every step of the way. A full hearing is still many months away.
I want these officers on the stand. I want them to feel like I felt, that if, when I was in the dock, the difference is they are guilty and I was innocent, and then they'll understand how it was for me. And when, hopefully, the right verdict is announced, then I want these police officers done for what they've done to me.
His case goes back to the murder of a Cardiff newsagent. Here again, the police appear to have an early lead. The victim had been battered to death with a spade. Soon afterwards, an eyewitness gave the police a description of a man acting suspiciously near the scene. They issued posters, appealing to the public for help. The description was of a 6-foot-tall man with black curly hair. That person was never traced. Instead, three teenagers were arrested. Michael O'Brien, his friend Ellis Sherwood, and the man with them, Darren Hall. They all came to be charged with murder. The strongest evidence was the confession of Darren Hall, but he was a fantasist who's since been diagnosed as a pathological liar.
I think what happened was that they tried to put together a case around Darren Hall and the two people he was with. The evidence didn't fit, so they were trying to create some more evidence to bolster the case and to make it look stronger. They must have realised that Darren Hall wasn't terribly reliable. So one final nice strong bit of evidence that would clinch matters would be an admission from Michael O'Brien and Ellis Sherwood.
The two were in next door cells in the police station when a detective said he overheard a shouted conversation.
They're going to charge me, you?
No, they're not. All they got is Hall. He's grassing us.
Can't hold out much longer. I may have to tell him the truth.
Don't do that, we'll be fucked.
I can't hold out much longer. I may have to tell him what's happened.
You're talking about life. Being on remand means nothing.
The officer claimed he was able to overhear what they shouted to each other.
Just keep your mouth shut.
He quickly scribbled down a note of it on the back of a police expenses form. What he'd recorded was close to a confession.
I think someone's listening. I'll catch up to you later, okay?
My reaction was one of horror. I turned to my sister and said, "Paul, this is effing lies." I remember the exact words I said to him. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. But I knew that we were up against it. I knew there was a serious, serious attempt to put us in prison for something we never done. And the worst thing about it, I felt so powerless. I couldn't do nothing about it. It was too late.
All three were convicted and jailed for life. Again, there'd been fabricated evidence, and again, innocent people were in prison.
Well, that's an extract from the excellent BBC Panorama documentary on the Clydach murders. That's Clydach murders in 1999, Martin. But it doesn't just include those murders. As you just heard there, there are all sorts of incidents where South Wales Police have simply been fitting people up for things they didn't do.
Yeah, I mean, of course, as we were hearing about in Parliament earlier, the question of who will guard the Guardians is an eternal question, isn't it? There has to be a rule of law.
I'll put a link up on our show page to that BBC Panorama from 1999. Sadly, the programme's really gone downhill. They don't do sorts of investigations like that anymore. I mean, this whole idea, though, Martin, of the trust in the rule of law in the criminal justice system is becoming more and more important, isn't it? It does seem as if the idea of people having faith in the justice system. I mean, we're looking at Julian Assange in a little while, specifically, is falling away. And so, what happens to a society when it can no longer trust that its highest courts will deliver fair verdicts of any sort?
Well, you only have to look around the world to see how that plays out. And even in the supposedly most democratic and law-abiding countries, there's plenty of skullduggery goes on. That's what courts and prisons are there to deal with.
So are the people who are committing these actually going to go? I mean, these QAnon conspiracy theories, which certainly I believe are there to feed people's fantasies, basically, that they're completely untrue. But the idea is to make you think that there is going to be some kind of change in the criminal justice system, either in Britain, America, or Europe, and some of these criminals are going to go to jail. Do you think that's possible?
Well, I mean, there's an awful lot of things going on. Basically, what we've got
about, for example, the criminal police in that case.
Yeah, well, the criminal police in that case, that sort of thing's been going on for donkey's years. It's hardly new. And of course,
we should just learn to live with it, should
no,
we?
No, I would argue that what's happened over the years is that police trying to cut corners like that has become more difficult in some respects because of things like handheld cameras and so on. And everybody having a mobile phone that they can immediately take photos, etc. And also, to some extent, the police have learned from past experience, and they're to some extent more professional than they used to be, because the West Midlands Crime Squad were notorious for fitting people up. And, it's been going on for a long time. It's not a new phenomenon, is it?
No, Chris Hewitt was on this programme, must be about a year ago, talking about these, what actually happened in the Birmingham bombings and Birmingham Six, saying that actually the policeman that fitted them up actually went on to retire, had a very nice retirement. That's the sort of thing that rather than being punished and being put behind bars for perverting the course of justice and all sorts of other crimes, to do, there seems to be some sort of system protecting crooks at that level.
Well, the system looks after its own, and in theory there are checks and balances to prevent that, but the government is just about to railroad a bill through Parliament to prevent not just the security service but loads of other organisations from being held accountable for their behaviour.
I'd just like to relate a story I heard a few weeks ago about Rebecca Brooks. She was the editor of the News of the World when she went to trial in June 2014 over phone hacking. Now, these are all extremely serious offences. Many of her colleagues who pleaded not guilty went to prison, but she didn't. And when he was drunk, her QC, Jonathan Laidlaw, apparently he explained how she had privileged access to control files on the jury. So profiles of the jury, so that when she gave her speech, she could play to the jury to say, and as part of her speech, she could psychologically make sure that they warmed to her. And she was acquitted.
Yes, she was a personal friend of David Cameron. And that's why she got that privileged treatment.
So, we're going to be now going over to look at this new organisation. It's called HATA, or Hold Authority to Account. The idea is that journalists in the northwest of England, mostly NUJ members, fed up with home working, redundancies and above all vested interests in government and censorship by their bosses, have got together to form a pressure group that is Hold Authority to Account. So I'm joined on the line by Henry Widdus, who was on our show, must be a couple of months ago now, Henry. You were talking about going into supermarkets for your paper and just seeing the extent to which or not that the masks were being enforced. But I know that you're quite concerned about the way that journalists particularly are being affected by this. Can you just introduce yourself and tell us a bit about why the interest in journalism as a whole, rather than just doing this as a reporter?
My name's Henry Widdus. I'm a JPI Media page manager in the Northwest, but I'm also the chairman of the Northwest Lancashire branch of the National Union of Journalists. And since March, I've been sort of looking to get a counter argument to, you know, the overwhelming narrative that COVID is extremely deadly. And I just wanted to get a bit of balance. And back in April, I started looking at the Off Guardian website, and I did a sort of an opinion piece in the paper, which I thought might turn a few heads and, you know, get some of my colleagues questioning about what was really going on, you know, sort of quoting all sorts of, you know, scientific people who, like, Professor Gupta, from Oxford University. I, like, referenced her back in April. Of course, she's in the news at the moment, front page of the Daily Mail today, I think, setting up a petition with other epidemiologists to say that lockdown's devastating. But anyway, so I referenced her back then, saying that the scaremongering from Professor Propaganda Neil Ferguson could be, you know, orders of magnitude out. Anyway, since April, nothing's happened. The overwhelming narrative has continued. Most of my colleagues are, you know, on board with that. I'm not, so I'm sticking out like a sore thumb. As a result, I've also had to step down because I didn't want to split in the chapel that I represented for JPI Media. There's a split between those who are sort of anti-lockdown and or lockdown questioning and those who were very supportive of lockdown. So I thought, with me being the representative for them, I was going to divide the chapel and maybe we would lose uni membership. So I've stepped down from there. But we've myself and Ben Butler, who's also online with us, have decided to set up a group of journalists who are willing to question lockdown. You know, we do so in the paper, but we just do so in newsrooms and over Zoom chats. And just off the cuff, we called it Hold Authority to Account, which has the acronym HATA. And I just had an idea. If it takes off, we'll have to have T-shirts. HATA will do nicely.
Okay, so Ben, could you introduce yourself? Tell us a bit about why you thought it was worthwhile joining such a group.
Yes, I'm Ben Butler. I work as a reporter for JPI Media Northwest, and I felt it was important to set up this group because I feel that the mainstream media coverage and also the local media coverage is far too heavily skewed in terms of the government line, and that we're not hearing those alternative voices from other scientists that are challenging the whole agenda around lockdowns and restrictions and surrounding the threat of the virus. I feel like the job of the media is to challenge authority, not to be the mouthpieces for the government. If we wanted to do that, we'd be in North Korea or China. So I felt it was really important to set up the group to act as a focal point for journalists to share mainstream media coverage of the COVID-19 crisis. The group's there to challenge it, but it's also there for people of all views, including those sceptical of a cause. We don't want it to be a kind of conspiracy theory type group, but we just want to provide some balance to a certain narrative that's conveyed in the mainstream media that COVID is a deadly threat to us all, and that these restrictions are justified when in reality they're not.
Well, hang on, because, you know, the government, in a way, you know, they have the medical experts there, Ben, and you're not a medical expert, you're a journalist. I mean, they are far better equipped to determine what the threat is than you are, surely.
I openly admit I'm not a scientist, but I have worked as a health reporter in my previous job at the Lancashire Telegraph, and I've also read alternative views from scientists such as Sinetra Gupta at Oxford University, Carl Hennigan, also at Oxford University, Professor Carol Sikora, and all these scientists are saying that this lockdown wasn't necessary and that there is an alternative path.
Well, it's true. I mean, for example, we've had Dolores Cahill, who was one of the most respected epidemiologists in Europe. She's been extremely outspoken about it. She's been going to rallies in Trafalgar Square and goodness knows what, speaking about it. So why is it that those scientists that challenge the government have not been getting a view?
I just think that it's because it doesn't fit in with the government's own agenda. From what I was reading, up until about March the 12th, the government were following the herd immunity approach of Sweden. But then they changed course when Professor Propaganda Ferguson, as Henry calls him, come in, and we all of a sudden went down the lockdown line, even though there was no evidence to suggest that to suggest that that makes any difference whatsoever. And I think we're starting to see the tide turn now. We've seen the front page in the Daily Mail today, 4,000 medical experts and doctors calling for a change in direction away from lockdowns to protecting the elderly and the vulnerable and letting everyone else get on with their lives. And that's something that I, from the very start, have felt we should have done in the same way that Sweden have done and done it to a lot of success. They've actually got a lower death rate than the likes of lockdown Spain and lockdown UK. So I think there should be a lot more coverage in the media of that and these alternative voices from scientists, because there just isn't enough of it nationally or locally.
No, it's become very unbalanced. I think you're absolutely right. But look, Henry, what do you think I'll ask you the same question I asked Ben. Why is it, do you think, that only certain experts that back the government have been getting airtime? It does look as if there's actually a specific programme of censorship. I mean, I had a look at the Ofcom guidelines, which were put out, this is back in March, I think it was the 26th of March, which talk about health claims and medical advice which is harmful, which is put out by radio stations covered by Ofcom and TV channels, will be punished by Ofcom with sanctions. But of course, now looking back on it, the medical advice by the government to remove people from hospitals and put them into care homes without being tested has possibly killed tens of thousands of people. And that, of course, was peddled by all of the TV channels and the newspapers at the time pretty much uncritically. So, bizarrely, they all should have been sanctioned by Ofcom for not criticising what the government was doing, which was giving bad health advice. But so what's your take on why the coverage has been so one-sided?
To put it simply, I would say you just follow the money and ask who benefits. And as an example of that, there's the SAGE group of the government, which is the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies. That's co-chaired by Sir Patrick Vallance, who's the sort of one of the lead doctors advising the government, and he's just recently been revealed to have £600,000 worth of shares in GlaxoSmithKline. And there's also another worrying aspect of the SAGE group is, I think we talked about this last time briefly, is the SPY-B subgroup, which is that stands for the Scientific Pandemic Influenza Group on Behaviour and Communication, and that sort of specialises in manipulating the population to comply and be coerced to obey these lockdown measures, which, as Ben was saying, are extreme and unnecessary. So, you know, there's the manipulation line of, you know, A, censoring the doctors who are, or experts who have an alternative view, and B, propaganda to ensure that most people comply, and even if they don't believe it.
You know, there was legal action, wasn't there, back, I think it was in April or May, to force SAGE to publish their minutes, which you would have thought that this is not a question of national security. So, you know, actually publishing the SAGE minutes should be done normally, but it wasn't, and they had to force them to do it. But we're now in the situation where local authorities, in conjunction with government, are making some of these decisions. Still, none of the evidence behind any of these lockdowns is being published, so it can't be scrutinised. What does that mean, Ben, do you think, for journalists who are trying to explain to the public why something has been decided when they're not allowed to know what the evidence is behind decisions?
Well, I think they're just unable to do the jobs properly. The job of a journalist is to hold authority to account, and we're unable to do that because of things like this. And at the end of the day, we live in a democratic country where we've got a free press, and if I wanted to go to North Korea or China, I would, and that's increasingly how it's feeling with the way that this is going.
Talking about money, I think both of you have mentioned that to a certain extent. Certainly you did, Henry. You know, people making money out of things. One of the people who's been quite outspoken about this for a long, long time, the idea of the vaccine companies having too much power in the lobbies, apparently the big pharmaceutical industries, otherwise known as Big Pharma, have got more lobbying clout even than the arms companies. And when you look at the arms sales to Yemen and Saudi Arabia, well, to Saudi Arabia to kill the Yemeni people, which are going into their tens of billions, you would think that the arms industry had a pretty powerful lobby. But apparently, Big Pharma is even more powerful. The producer of the documentary Vaxxed, which was due to play at the Sundance Film Festival a few years ago, about some of the dangers of vaccines, and we're not saying that you should never take a vaccine, but there are certainly dangers associated with these things that people need to know about so they can make a conscious choice when they decide whether or not to have them. There's this principle, basic principle, which is called informed consent, where a doctor advises you, I think this is the best thing for you to do, and then you decide for yourself whether you want to take that treatment or not. But anyway, Del Bigtree actually says, he said before all of this, this was, I believe, around about December last year or January 2020, that the pharmaceutical industry wanted to turn the vaccine business from a $50 billion a year business into a $1 trillion a year business in one fell swoop. And this is actually what they seem to be achieving with this whole COVID-19 program. So just as by way of a little break, let's have a listen now to this speech by Del Bigtree to one of the committees of Congress about 9 or 10 months ago, before the COVID-19 outbreak.
People need to know. Yeah. Not a single childhood vaccine has ever been tested against an inert placebo. They never admitted that until we challenged them on it. In that meeting, we said we cannot find any double-blind inert placebo study for a single one of the 16 childhood vaccines that we give our children. Are they not being done, or are you not showing them? Are we looking at the wrong websites? Because we've read every single scientific piece of information from our government and from the manufacturers. At first, one of the scientists said, oh, we do double-blind experiments. They're just in early trial phases. And we said, fine, we're sitting at the National Institute of Health. Please bring those in right now, because they would be here. They couldn't provide that. And then Tony Fauci, head of infectious disease, said, we don't do double-blind experiments with placebos because it would be unethical. So our medical establishment has decided that it's unethical to have a placebo group, and therefore not a single childhood vaccine has ever established a safety control. We don't know if they're safe. There's no way to say they're safe. Essentially, we've decided in this country and around the world that it's more ethical to give a product that's never been through a safety study to every child in the country. Now what they'll say is, well, we've been running it for a very long time, and it's proven to be safe. Well, really, we have the sickest generation of children this country has ever seen. We have seen the largest decline in public health in history. We have gone from 12.8% chronic illness, so neurological or autoimmune diseases in the 1980s, before we took liability away, when we were getting 10 vaccines. Then we took liability away from the industry. They could no longer be sued if their products injured anyone. And now, in 2019, we're giving 72 vaccines, and our chronic illness rate in our children is 54%. We've gone from 12 to 54% chronic illness. That means neurological disorders in 1 in 6 of our children. 1 in 7 has a speech delay. 1 in 4 is leaving elementary school on a drug they're going to be on the rest of their lives. The point being, this is the greatest crash in public health we've ever seen. We have more babies dying on the first day of life than every other industrialized nation combined. These are all facts. I can back them up. I'll show a lot of them are cited here. We have more babies dying in the first year of life than the 20 other richest nations in the world. And we're now reporting we're 70% more likely to die before reaching 18 in America than the 20 other richest nations. What is the reason for this? Well, there's two things that I think people say, well, you're saying vaccines are doing all of that. We now have science that's happening all over the world that's showing how vaccines are definitely contributing to the problem. But here's the point. Should we be listening to health departments? Should we be making laws based on recommendations from a health department that has overseen the greatest decline in public health in world history? I think that we really need to look twice. And I would urge any politician to say, I want to see the science from the other side. They keep saying there's thousands of studies that show that vaccines don't cause autism. We've read them. They're not there. Those science studies do not exist. They are not there. There are 14 total studies looking at autism, and half of them are on the MMR vaccine and the other on thimerosal. When they say vaccines, plural, do not cause autism, they have only looked at one vaccine out of 16 vaccines. Most parents are complaining that the DTaP vaccine causes autism, and the Institute of Medicine looked into it, and you know what they found? Not a single study has ever looked at the comparison of autism and the DTaP vaccine. They said, we can neither confirm nor deny whether the DTaP vaccine causes autism, and that's what's cited by the CDC. That study is what they cite when they say vaccines, plural, do not cause autism. That's a fraud. That's a fraud being perpetrated by the CDC. And so the warning that I would be giving from your team to everyone else is, you can be the first Nazi in, and throughout history, when we start book burning, when we start censoring speech, when we start using bullying tactics to move society instead of information and science, we know we're coming to our end. And we don't want to see the government fail. We do not want to see oppression. And by the way, this oppression, laws like this, taking away this exemption, is making our movement explode. Mm-hmm. It is exploding. Mm-hmm. And measles is exploding, because what would you do if you were told you were going to be quarantined from being able to be in a synagogue on Passover? You'd say, let's go ahead and get the measles out of the way right now so that we can never be quarantined again. They are causing what they call an epidemic. How do you call something an epidemic when everyone in it is trying to get the measles? That's what's happening in England. Right. No one's running from it. This is not Ebola.
No, 5,000
people have to go get your vaccine this week. You're going to say, hold on a second, I've been healthy for 15 years without a vaccine, and so is every adult in this country. So they're going to remove the exemptions before they bring the adult mandate. The pharmaceutical industry isn't the number one most powerful lobby in Washington, outspending oil and gas simply because they want to waste time in Washington. They have one product, the vaccine industry, that cannot be sued, doesn't have to go through safety studies, so there's no cost on this product. There's no risk on this product. We have 72 vaccines now, 270 have been approved, and thousands are in trials as we speak. The future of this industry is vaccines, and every politician they can buy to force more vaccines into the population, they're going to make money. But the moment the adult mandate comes, I assure you, pharma's not fighting for the 2% of the unvaccinated kids. They want 320, 40 million Americans, wherever we're at right now, indentured to a program that will turn the pharmaceutical industry from a $1 billion industry, $50 billion they're making from vaccines right now, into a $1 trillion industry overnight. That is what is taking place, and it is people like you and great politicians that are protecting us right now, as they should, from one of the most dangerous industries that has paid out over $30 billion in damages for having killed us with products they knew were dangerous.
So that was the producer of the documentary Vaxxed in the United States, featuring the discredited Dr. Andrew Wakefield, amongst others. He was speaking there to one of the congressional committees charged with overseeing the pharmaceutical industry in the United States. Amazing to hear, Henry, that the big pharma has got this ambition, or it did have the end of last year, to go from a $50 billion to a $1 trillion industry. Now, let's just think about that in terms of 20 times. Any industry that can press a button and increase its turnover by 20 is going to make quite a lot of money for its shareholders.
Yeah, it is absolutely shocking how much of a money spent in vaccines are. And I was completely clueless about vaccines until this was really going on, and I started looking into it. And it is quite shocking. And I may even have asthma because of a vaccine I had when I was 8 years old. I was like, I had these sort of various school vaccines. And then a few months later, I developed asthma. And, I've never, ever made a connection between the two in my whole life. Suddenly, I've been reading all reports of what vaccines can cause. So, I think there's informed consent is the key here. And I really think we're quite possibly sleepwalking into a world where informed consent goes on the back burner. So that's why, another reason why we've set up this group, so we can just hold authorities to account, keep questioning, keep asking the uncomfortable questions, encourage lots of other journalists to join up, and then we're hoping to maybe even release an official statement to journalistic publications like Hold the Front Page to state there's three things that I would hope that the other members agree with, and that is censorship on the mainstream, on global media platforms like Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, where like that Dolores, vaccine expert you mentioned, she's like censored left, right, and center.
She is.
So that's just chucking informed consent out the window when people can't even see the counter-argument on vaccines. And then the other argument that, as Ben's mentioned, is it's just being quite unbalanced, the questioning of lockdown and COVID. It's all around, you know, within the narrow parameters of, okay, yeah, COVID's extremely deadly, so we should have locked down earlier, we should have had more PPE. There's very, very little questioning of, hang on, this isn't quite so deadly as we're being told, and the statistics show that. So, yeah, that's the second one. And then the third one that I wanted to raise, but I'm not sure all members would agree, is that just, you know, I haven't even got a TV licence, but when I go to my girlfriend's, I'm subjected to this morning TV, which is quite interesting to see the counter-argument. And, you know, even like to Spotify and, you know, every media outlet is, and radio, it's just, you're pumped with adverts from the Cabinet Office, and it's paid by the taxpayer.
Well,
and to me, it's propaganda.
What I would say about that is that on talk radio, you're getting quite a different one. But talk radio, for some bizarre reason, has been booted off, or have decided to go off of DAB, and they're now on DAB Plus. So you have to get a special DAB Plus radio in order to listen to talk radio now. With Julia Hartley Brewer, Mike Graham, and people like that on there.
I could invite them on the group, actually. They might be willing to join.
Yeah, but isn't it strange how suddenly they're pushed onto a new type of digital radio that hardly anybody has got a digital radio receiver that can even pick it up? This DAB Plus stuff, you know, is something which is actually very inaccessible. Most people are having to listen to that via the internet. So anyway, back to you, Ben. Threat and the restrictions, how do you think that that's been balanced, and what do you think the threat really is?
I don't think the threat is anything like how it's being portrayed to be. I think the way we've got to look at it is health, education, employment, finances and social and mental well-being of the population is effectively being destroyed for this illusory goal of stopping the spread of a coronavirus that I believe is essentially harmless to 99% of the population and lethal almost exclusively to the elderly with serious underlying medical conditions. And I just feel that the restrictions in light of the threat of the virus are just totally unjustified. And the reason why we've seen an increase in cases recently is because we've had more testing, and we've got the whole issue around the dubious polymerase chain reaction, which is actually harmless fragments of the virus that aren't actually cases of it. And I just feel that the whole approach to it is completely skewed. There's so much scaremongering in the media from the mainstream scientists and the government. Obviously, we saw Witty and Balance with the 50,000 cases by mid-October. And looking at the evidence, there's no evidence that that's going to happen. They were saying 200 deaths by October. Again, that's not going to happen. So the whole debate around it is completely skewed in one direction, and the restrictions that we've seen are completely disproportionate to the actual threat of the virus.
Have you seen that any of your editors or, you know, subs and people like this, you know, actually at the coalface, have taken any of this on board?
I don't think nationally and locally the media have done enough to challenge the narrative by the government that's being peddled out, and we're not hearing those views from the alternative scientists and the arguments against lockdowns and restrictions. All we're hearing is how COVID is a very deadly virus and that we need these restrictions to beat it. Although in reality, will we actually ever get rid of it? Even if a vaccine comes along, the chances are it's still going to be there, like it is with flu. So I think we've just got to learn to live with it, and I just don't think that any of this has been reflected in the national or the local media coverage.
We have a bit of a break and have a listen to some music. And as I mentioned, Del Bigtree there, the US documentary producer. And we heard a bit from him that we should hear a song which appears, I mean, this is really only my conspiracy theory, if you want, a bit of guesswork, by Ian Brown, the frontman from the Stone Roses.
We don't need no stinking badges.
grip us all, to have complete control, and let us guide your soul. Peace like silence in the snow. Free to do exactly as you're told. Psychological operation, the general population hypnotized right in front of your eyes. Drama and lies, look into my eyes. Just a little seed makes a big tree, standing on its own, thriving all alone. Just a little seed makes a big tree, grows so high, gonna touch the sky. Just a little seed makes a big tree, spreads roots deep, branches far and wide. Masonic lockdown in your hometown. Masonic lockdown, can you feel me now? Masonic lockdown, soul shutdown, stay shake down, a mass breakdown. Put your muzzle on, get back in your basket, get behind your doors, cause living here is drastic. Dr. Evil and his needle, Dr. Evil with a master plan, a false vaccine like a bad dream. The plan to microchip every woman, child and man. The plan to chip us all, to have complete control, the land, the sky, our soul.
So that was Little Seed, Big Tree. My conspiracy theory is it's dedicated to Del Big Tree, who's one of the, most respected anti-pharmaceutical industry child protection documentary makers in the United States, and the singer's Ian Brown from the Stone Roses. And joining me is Henry Widdus and Ben Butler, both from journalists from up north. Look, can I just ask you first, Ben, what about working? Because how has the working conditions for journalists changed?
It's been a complete change. We've gone from being office-based and going to court and council meetings and getting out and about in the public to working at home remotely. I'm working in Gorton at the moment, which is some 45 minutes away from where my work is based, and the remote working has been a real challenge in terms of staying in contact with your contacts and just getting out and meeting people and doing your job. It's heavily restricted. You can't go to court the same, to council. They are doing things on streams and stuff, but it's just not the same. So there are a lot of real challenges, and the practicalities for a journalist to work from home, it's just not realistic. It's not like an office job. It's one of them jobs where you do need to be out and about and in the office, and we're just not able to do that at the moment. Well,
I mean, the annoying thing is, of course, that by actually outsourcing people to their home address, it suddenly becomes much easier for these big media companies to say, well, actually, I'm sorry, we're making you redundant and we're bringing in people who are doing your job from abroad, maybe from India or somewhere like that. I mean, is there any potential for that, do you think?
Well, that's what worries me, that the longer that we work from home and work remotely, the longer that these restrictions go on, the bigger the threat to our jobs. We're obviously seeing people in all kinds of different industries being made redundant, and you do fear that the same thing could happen with journalism.
But Ben, you know, the newspaper industries, particularly the regional and local newspapers, have been saying for many years that there is a crisis of survival there, that they may not survive. So maybe this, you know, sort of getting rid of offices, you know, slimming down might actually enable you to keep your job.
That is a good counter argument, and you are right to say that if we get rid of the offices, then you'd save money in that sense. But I just think if you go to a system of remote working, it will give them an excuse to make job cuts and to make redundancies, and like you've said, to maybe have someone globally doing something, and that journalism on the ground in the town will be gone, and that's a big chunk of democracy that's just disappeared. And I do want to bring in the union as well, the National Union of Journalists. I don't think as a union they've done anywhere near enough to challenge these restrictions, to question them and to stand up for our jobs, because ultimately the longer these restrictions go on, the longer that we work remotely from home, the more likely we are to face the prospect of redundancy. And I think that the union could have done a lot more.
Yeah, well, the union is probably, fair to say, it's only as good as its members, Ben. So have you been lobbying the union? What have you been trying to get them to do?
I've attended a number of meetings, and I've got across my points of view, and I know Henry has as well. And but there's only so much you can do. The majority of the members seem to be generally in favour of the restrictions, and yeah, there's only so much.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because they may end up losing their jobs as a result. Henry, what do you make of the working conditions? Have things changed for you?
Well, I was already working from home a couple of days a week, so it wasn't as much of a shock to the system. And because I'm sort of like a page manager, I'm just working on InDesign, sort of, you know, laying out pages, doing headlines and so on. So it's not been that much of a change for me. And the one thing I do miss, and the one thing that I think Ben hit on, it's a very key point, that journalism should really be an office-based job, because you've got new recruits coming through, and the way they learn is sitting next to a senior reporter, learn the ropes, you know, learn the tricks of the trade, if you like, and now they're just being left out in a lurch, you know, with no sort of physical contact, and, you know, there's only so much you can communicate from a Zoom meeting, and more often than not, I've just found that we just communicate via emails, and you don't learn as much. And as you know, like, you have sort of a conversation face to face, you can reach a conclusion and get somewhere much, much quicker than you can if you're just exchanging emails back and forth.
Well, no, you're right. And I know you are really concerned as well about the way that the care homes I mentioned earlier, but that whole angle to this story has been almost a national scandal, bigger than the COVID itself, because so many people died, elderly people, vulnerable people died because of decisions made by the government's chief medical officer and the chief scientific officer.
Yeah, I was going to mention that, actually, that within the mainstream media, just to go back to the journalists, actually, we were talking about how they can you know, just select to choose one argument when they're writing stories for the paper. But I think everyone I work with, they've got incredible integrity. They work really hard. But there's just a lack of knowledge of these blind spots, which includes the, you know, do not resuscitate orders in care homes, and how people on existing doctors' treatments from hospital had those withheld when the lockdown came in because doctors were no longer going to the care homes. Don't forget, care homes are basically large hospitals in themselves where a lot of people there are waiting to die or are near death. So suddenly withholding, you know, treatments for them, doing do not resuscitate orders, having a skeleton staff, who, you know, there's in the Spectator they were saying that, you know, staff residents in there were dying of thirst, and, you know, because they're in this COVID environment where doctors can give a diagnosis of COVID without a test, even according to the Coronavirus Act. You know, there's just been, it's been like a cauldron of like chaos that's allowed for the deaths to be seen to be spiking really highly because of COVID, when it could be the lockdown causing the death.
That's right. And the other thing, of course, is that because of the blocking of relatives, etc., visiting, you know, we've seen several occasions where people have been being very, very badly treated, that if their relatives knew the way that their elderly loved ones were being treated, they'd be absolutely mortified and would probably physically grab them and drag them out of the care home.
Yeah, that's very, very true. And I've got personal experience of that. Yeah, my mum sadly passed away, and she had various good nurses at the hospital and a couple of not very good ones. And the family was there. We were being proactive to make sure she had, you know, a good end of life. And it just, I don't even want to think about what some people have gone through in care homes, you know, with dementia. They're already fearful. And, you know, I visited my dad in a care home once, and they are horrendous places. You know, you hear screaming, and there's no nurses to go and see them, and, you know, it's just awful. So you know, when you've got relatives there, there's a safety net to protect them, but without we need whistleblowers from care homes, and there are some, but not many.
Well, that's right. And also the medical profession have been told by certainly all of the hospital trusts, the NHS trusts, that I've managed to get solid information from, have been telling their staff, never speak to a journalist. If you do, it's a sackable offence. That's pretty shocking, Henry.
Yeah. I mean, I know some journalists who've, you know, got like friends in the medical profession, and you know, that these friends in the medical profession are towing the party line, saying, yeah, it's a real serious thing and lockdown is necessary. And, you know, of course they would say that because their jobs depend on it. And it's also quite difficult for journalists like me and Ben, you know, I would argue that we're being quite brave stepping up here, setting up this group, because, you know, like any employee, there's in your contract, you cannot go around criticizing the company you work for. And, you know, I do want to stress that the company that me and Ben work for, JPI Media, they have been doing their best. And, you know, like newspaper groups in general were, been suffering with decades with chronic understaffing. So all the people around me, I can't fault them. They're doing a brilliant job. It's just I want to use this group, and me and Ben want to use this group to raise awareness with our colleagues that there is a counter argument.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot now, Ben. Take a step back from all of this. What's really going on? You know, because surely there must be some other agenda if there are attempts to muzzle the press and steer the government to certain decisions. I mean, you know, if the pharmaceutical industry actually makes more money the more people are sick, this is quite a worrying prospect, you know. So anyway, what do you think? What's the bigger agenda?
I think the bigger agenda is control. I think the ultimate aim is for global governments to control us as citizens. They've completely exaggerated the threat of this virus. They've had completely disproportionate restrictions, and yet the agenda is a global agenda by global governments to try and control us and to suppress us and turn us into some kind of big fascist state. And that's the kind of thing that I'm seeing, and it's extremely worrying.
It is worrying, isn't it, Henry, because we've seen in the past that when big corporations start funding political parties to mould society for their own benefit, and then they start to basically control the government, control the regulation of various industries, in this case healthcare, you know, capture basically the regulators, and so that the regulation isn't really happening because it's controlled by the industry itself. We've seen actually the same going on with the telecoms industry and 5G, that the ICNIRP, which is the regulator, two MEPs, 2 months ago came out with a report saying basically that the regulator of 5G is controlled by the 5G industry, so there isn't really any regulation of it. But what would you say about the pandemic and the response to it? If you take a step back from it, what's the real agenda?
I would say it's, control, definitely, exactly. I echo completely what Ben's just said. It's just about controlling citizens and the freedoms that we're willingly handing, you know, to the governments will not be given back unless we have a legacy media, if you like, that will hold authority to account. And we better start doing it soon.
I mean, it's almost with the masks, it's almost like China. I mean, certainly most, you know, a lot of, and it was became a norm, didn't it, in many Oriental countries, particularly around Beijing, to do with pollution. But now it seems that the mask is some sort of sign of compliance to control. So are we becoming a bit like China?
I would say so, yeah. I don't know what Ben thinks on that, but yeah, when I walk around the supermarkets, I do see, I don't wear a mask. I've got asthma, but I wouldn't wear a mask anyway. And I can't even go to the dentist now because they insisted that I had my temperature taken. So I'm not willing to bend the knee now because I'm not willing to, you know, I'm drawing the line.
I mean, he said, surely, hang on, Henry, that's surely sensible. If you've got a high temperature, you probably shouldn't be in there.
Well, I disagree because the government has its own website, and I had one of its pages shared with me that a high temperature is no indication that you've got COVID or not. That shouldn't be relied on as a test to see if you've got COVID or not. So it's just part of the overall staging of compliance. You know, it's like a totalitarian tiptoe, if you like. So for now, it's okay, just wear the mask. Well, let's go back to March, actually. It's just stay in your houses for 2 weeks while we flatten the curve. Yeah. As it transpired, the hospitals were, you know, like ghost ships anyway, from numerous sources. Of course, people wouldn't willingly officially go on the record saying that because they'd be, relieved. So as you were saying, it's a tackable offence to go against the script. And then after that, it's okay. Well, now the World Health Organization is saying it's airborne and we really should be wearing masks. Oh, okay, well, now you should really be having your temperature taken. You really now should be having your vaccination. You know, it's just going to go on and on. And, when we have this compulsory vaccinations coming out, I'm fairly sure they will do. It won't be compulsory in terms of being held down by a military person injected. You'll just be told there's various things you can't do. And those various things could even mean getting a job or going into an office. So I think...
You've suddenly done there is reminded me of China, where you can't travel if you've got a low social credit score. You put your credit card in to the machine to buy a train ticket and it just spits it out. And it says your credit card score doesn't allow you to travel.
Yeah, I've seen the documentaries on that, and that's where we're going with the health passports, and I think in Ireland they're introducing a sort of traffic light system where it's just in terms of testing, not even the of course we've not got the vaccine yet. So if you've been tested and they've been cleared, then you can do certain things. But if you're in the amber, then you need to have another test. And if you're red, then you've not been tested, and we don't know if you're safe or not. So that's another thing I'm refusing to. I won't be accepting any test. And even if that means I get put in jail for 2 weeks or whatever, I'm just not.
Okay. Well, look, Ben, is there any light at the end of the tunnel? Do you see that there is sort of any little sparks of resistance to these measures?
I'd like to think so, because obviously at first Boris Johnson was saying we'd near enough be back to normal by July. Then he was saying December. Now he's saying by the end of next year that social distancing restrictions might be done with. But it just seems to be going on and on and on. We're talking about this cherished vaccine that's going to solve everything. And it just seems to be going on and on. So at the moment, I really can't see any light at the end of the tunnel. I'm wanting to, but I just can't see any way out of this. We've already been told that the restrictions could be going on for 6 more months until March. And then I've read something that even when we get a vaccine, we could still be under restrictions. So just how long is this going to go on?
I suppose one positive thing I could say is that even though the TV is telling us that the police are very strict about all this kind of thing. When you actually speak to individual officers, they don't really seem to be very interested in enforcing these restrictions, and they're much more interested in carrying on doing their job and actually catching criminals. But anyway, what about you, Henry? Any light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, I think there is light at the end of the tunnel. You've described the sort of the control network that we're under, with sort of the government being able to manipulate the press and the press being able to manipulate the public. And for me, it's been forever thus. So we just have to operate within that environment, have strong voices out there questioning what's going on, and, you know, persuade public opinion that way. And it may come to a point where we have a split, a bit like with Brexit. Well, those who are pro-vax, and then there's going to be those who just want to have informed consent. And I would argue the pro-vaxxers are the ignorant ones, because they'll accept a vaccine without doing the research. In fact, when I have debates about vaccines, it tends to be the people who agree with me have done research, and those who disagree with me quite vehemently have not done any research on it. It's just about sharing information. That's where my positivity is coming from.
Yeah, good. Well, somebody who has done a lot of research on it is a woman called Julie Beale, who I interviewed recently, and she has actually uncovered, I think, what I think is the big scandal, which is that the gene editing qualities of these new vaccines. She actually says that they shouldn't be called vaccines because they're not based on any sort of normal traditional pathogen, which vaccines always have been in the past. But these new types of vaccines, she calls them the RonaVax, because they are there to edit your genes. They go into your cells and they snip various bits of your DNA and that sort of thing. And the other thing that she mentioned, which is, it's fascinating. Did you know that these gene editing so-called vaccines, what she calls the RonaVax, or the Rona scam, she uses the word, have been actually in development for over 30 years, but they've never been able to get any approval for them. And they believe that is, when I say they, Big Pharma, these big pharmaceutical companies, that this is going to be sort of a little hump for them to get over so that they can now get these vaccines that the RonaVax is, the gene editing ones, approved, whereas before they might not have done. So, but I mean, there is a lot of awareness out there. For me, the most positive thing has been seeing a lot of young people doing things like having raves, where they have made a conscious decision that they want to catch whatever this is. They want to get together because they believe that, and the government studies will actually bear them out, that not a single young person has actually died of COVID-19. Not one in the UK. Some have died, obviously, with pre-existing conditions. And so it is quite a reasonable argument to say that we should not have closed schools down for 6 months. So kids have been deprived of their education, arguably, for 6 months for nothing. And I don't think that the young people are going to take this lying down. I think that there's certainly an awareness amongst them of a sort of globalist plan. The idea that the government is not actually there as a benevolent thing to help you, and that there are all sorts of problems with our democracy. Youngsters have got that, I think, and that for me is one of the big pluses. Anyway, so Ben Butler and Henry Widdes, thanks very much for joining us. Maybe, Henry, you could just say again what is the name of your group in case any journalists listening are interested in getting in touch.
Yeah, well, it's called Hold Authority to Account. So we haven't got a website or anything. We're just like sort of a WhatsApp group, just sharing stories, really, about our experiences of covering COVID.
How do people get in touch with you?
Well, they could drop me an email. It's henrywiddes@gmail.com. I'll spell that. So Henry, normal spelling, and then Widdes is Whiskey Indigo Delta Delta Alpha Sierra. And then, yeah, @gmail.com. And then if they just email me, give the sort of job title. I mean, we don't sort of say who's working where on the group. We just, just the rule is that we're journalists, and give me their phone number, and then I can just add them. And it's Ben's also a moderator on the group, so he can add people as well. So far, we've got a dozen members. We only set it up last week, and yeah, we've got 12 members, hoping to get to maybe 50 by Christmas.
Okay, we'll finish. with another song, and that is called COVID-19 the Musical, and I hope you're going to dance along. It's by a group called Frankie Goes to Nowhere. Ben Butler and Henry Willis, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Every day, 19. Every day, 19.
Snitches get rewards. We want to thank you for turning folks in and making sure we are all safe.
7 billion people.
Oh, that's Bill Gates there. Dr. Fauci from the US, rounding off that discussion we had earlier this week with the Hatters, the whole authority to account journalists from the Northwest. That's Henry Widdus and Ben Butler. The points raised there, Martin, really are all to do with the way the profession is changing. Apparently, they're even getting CGI presenters on Chinese television.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, the print media have obviously crashed completely over recent years. And, you know...
So this is all an economic thing? No.
Well, underlying...
It's not. It's basically about controlling the news. It's a bit like what's going on with drones, taking the human factor out of warfare. They're taking the human factor out of journalism.
Yes, and it is to do with economics. You're right. And economics determines everything. Journalism, like every other capitalist industry, is determined by the economics.
I don't think it's to do with economics. I think it's
not just to do with economics.
Psychological warfare, effectively.
Well, there's psychological warfare as well, but print journalism is on the out because it's basically been destroyed by the way in which modern technology works. And that is, you know, and then on top of that, you've got all of these intelligence services, corporate bosses and so on. They've got their agenda. They control the old agenda. They control the new agenda because they're the ones who control the agenda.
It's in a little bit Max Headroom, isn't it, this? The idea of having a CGI presenter and the AI, some sort of bot in your processor that's written that day's news.
Well, Max Headroom was very much a product of the 1980s, so you could see that it was a bot. The real problem is that, doctoring videos and so on, where you don't know that it is a bot, and that you can actually mimic people's voices and create evidence of all sorts of things. You know, this is the world
we're
moving into.
It's pretty obvious where we're heading, isn't it? That the idea here is that there will no longer be any kind of balanced journalism. There will no longer even be ordinary journalists to tell you the news. A lot of it, of course, is based in London, the national news. And I think this is one of the reasons why we're seeing a bit of pushback from regional news centres, where they're saying, well, hang on a minute, you know, basically we're not going to be here in a few years' time. We're finding that the actual agendas that we're being told to write about, we don't agree with, we don't believe. And so there is some pushback. The idea of taking the human element out of our journalism is actually extremely chilling. There is a fascistic element to it, Martin, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I mean, the word fascism, of course, is overused, but clearly it's about control.
Or should we say totalitarian?
Yeah, okay,
should we say authoritarian?
Yeah.
The idea that journalism is not there to tell the people what's going on. Of course, the parallels with what's happening to Julian Assange should be very apparent.
It is, but don't forget that most journalists throughout most of modern history have been there to big up the corporate sponsors who pay their wages or the governments that they work in for indirectly. The number of investigative journalists who actually investigated evil by authority, you can count on one or two hands. Most journalism has actually been propaganda. People who get paid quite good salaries to write every day for the Daily Mail and the Sun.
I don't think
mostly,
it was always
mostly rubbish.
It certainly wasn't always like this. I would suggest that, you know, there was a little bit of messing around by editors and managers in the 60s, 70s and 80s. We saw an enormous step change at the BBC when Victor Rothschild had the director general sacked. That was in 1987, the director general being Alastair Milne, whose son Seamus Milne was the director of communications for Jeremy Corbyn. We heard Kath Viner recently, Martin, didn't we, at The Guardian, saying that she would under no circumstances would she be allowing Seamus Milne to have his column back at The Guardian. Why is that?
Well, that's because The Guardian has got its own corporate sponsors. They've got a section of the market that they're trying to dominate, which is what you might call the educated liberals, as Julian Assange has said. And they basically want to police the terms of the debate, and therefore Seamus Milne is not welcome.
Anyway,
but then don't forget, as a private organisation, just like all these other organisations...
They can do what they want, just like the private TV in places like Venezuela.
No, well, yes, indeed, that's right.
And that's why they've had to have a state-run telesur.
Well, that's right, So what you've got to do, unless you're going to close these people down, you've got to create your own alternative, either by the state creating an alternative, and that is perfectly legitimate, or otherwise it really is just the loudest voice...
Private media can actually play quite an important role in coups, for example, can't it?
Well, it certainly... There's a huge effort. I mean, there's over the last 20, 30 years, you had Berezovsky in Russia, you had Maldonado in Brazil, you had Berlusconi in Italy, who were basically big media moguls, who were the wealthiest people in the society, controlled huge chunks of the mass media, and were also politicians. And that is actually becoming a normal.
And weren't the banksters behind them?
Well, of course they borrow financing, money from the banks. Yes,
financing these guys. Basically, they'll say, well, here's a few billion. Go and create yourself a media. I mean, we're sitting in the People's Republic of Stokes Croft here, which is a little bit like a, I hate to say this, I shouldn't tell Chris Chalkley I've said this, but it's a bit like a squat. You know, it's a bit untidy. And it's not certainly one
it's
of these.
It's not a corporate headquarters.
No, it definitely isn't. But of course, the money behind this, Martin, the money is from the banksters, and they are actually the people surely responsible for making and breaking these giant media moguls, people like Rupert Murdoch.
Well, when you say banksters, it's a shorthand. These people are the banksters. Berlusconi has got shares in lots of big banks, as well as owning the media. Yeah?
They've got their own private wealth as well.
Well, exactly. So the point is that it's all that these people are the global elite, and they control most mainstream media. I mean, if you go to Italy, you will see loads of TV stations are pumping out pro-right-wing propaganda day in,
it's
day out.
It's basically pornography pretending to be news.
Well, you could say that. I mean, it looks, from a British point of view, it looks very, you know, very questionable. Lots of teenage girls taking their kit off and then over to the news, which is all about how terrible the left-wing government are, etc.
And you mean actually the same girls taking their kit into the news studio
In Russia, during the Bezpredel years, there was a very popular TV show where girls with their tops off read the news, and that was very popular, but it was very different from the Soviet era and not necessarily better.
Okay, we're going to move on to do a bit more background now. We're used to looking at Assange too, Black History Month, how from the 1960s Boston in the US it was a plague of gentrification, meant a secret Negro removal program which was rolled out right across the Western world. So we have a look at that. And also the pinch point between East and West. The last year, over a quarter of the population, 2 million people, were out on the streets protesting in Hong Kong. Now the number is zero. With the combination of the national security law and the COVID provisions, what's life like now over in the former British colony? We hear from expat Robert Hansen, who lives there, and also the UN General Assembly. As they close, we hear one of the last speeches from Colonel Gaddafi back in 2009. Such a shame he's not around to make these explosive speeches, and maybe because he was making them is one of the reasons they got rid of him. He talks about US assassins over the last 50 years. And you've heard about the Bay of Pigs and the bringing in the greenback dollar as a reason to get rid of John F. Kennedy. Well, Gaddafi suggests another reason. And we've also heard the Grand Master of Scottish Rite Freemasons, Albert Pike, in the US, set up a plan for wars and revolutions. This time we hear from his correspondent over in Italy, Giuseppe Mazzini. Also the IRA kicking out the British after the First World War. And finally, David Icke, a little look at plagiarism by him, a guy called Brian Desborough. He basically cut and pasted Brian Desborough's work and then published it as a book called The Biggest Secret. Of course, The Biggest Secret was probably that he never wrote it at all. So, Martin, on to the Julian Assange case now. Even though there's been no hearings this week, I think it's very important to keep track. And certainly some people have been commenting that, of course, none of this has been heard in The Guardian. There was some criticism, by the way, this week from Jonathan Cook, saying, why has George Monbiot not really commented, apart from retweeting a couple of things about the Assange case, since it's such an important case? Do you think it's fair to criticise individual journalists like Monbiot for not really having anything to say about this?
Well, Jonathan Cook used to work at The Guardian, so he knows of what he speaks. Monbiot's position is that he does kind of support Assange, but he doesn't see it as a priority, and he tweeted this week that soil loss was more important to him than Julian Assange. That's up to him to say that, but of course, Jonathan Cook was saying in his piece this week was that Monbiot knows exactly how far he can go, and if he wants to carry on having a rather lucrative platform in The Guardian, he's got to stick to what The Guardian wants to say. And if he says more than that, eventually he's got, like Seamus Milne, he ain't going to be required back.
Well, it'd be interesting to see what the editor Kath Viner has to say about that, whether she would say, well, actually, George Monbiot can say what he wants.
Well, he can say what he wants, but the point is, if you carry on doing that, eventually your contract will not be renewed, which is exactly what's happened to Seamus Milne.
This is the point, isn't it, with the whole Assange case, if people speak out too much about it, they're worried. So how much of this is real threats to people's careers, like Monbiot's, and how much is fear, Martin? Because there's a lot of fear.
Well, what happens is, you know, if you've got a mortgage, as we were talking about mortgages earlier, and kids, there's a limit to what you're prepared or not prepared to do, unless you're very, very brave.
Also, what's the point of being a journalist with no audience?
Well, indeed. So, in other words, you've got to, in order to get onto the platforms where you can communicate your ideas, then you've got to make some compromises. It's the same as true in politics, the same as true in life. And, of course, there's not actually a right and a wrong answer to what people should do,
I mean,
in the face of that
sort
of
pressure. We're going to listen now to somebody who will not be on The Guardian, because Kath Viner is editing it. And his name is Craig Murray. He was the our man in the public gallery right the way through this incredible, extraordinary rendition, extraordinary extradition hearing. So this is what Craig Murray had to say last week, the end of last week.
The United States is claiming a universal jurisdiction to swoop down anywhere in the world and destroy the life of anybody who publishes things it does not want revealed. And this ridiculous claim of universal jurisdiction should not be accepted or tolerated for a moment in a British court, let alone granted all the panoply of justice, so-called, which is defending this indefensible situation.
Well, he's picking up the point there of the Americans trying to say that their law applies all over the world. And they've also said, extraordinary enough, Pompeo's on the record of saying this, that the Constitution of the United States guarantees freedom of speech, but only to American citizens. So Assange is simultaneously not an American citizen, therefore not entitled to freedom of speech, but he's also subject to American law, even though he's not an American citizen, and he's not entitled to freedom of speech. That is the Orwellian conclusion that one can draw from this top British court's proceedings.
Well, supposedly top, but this judge, Vanessa Baritza, Westminster Magistrates Court, there's no jury here. She's deciding on her own, and she's not going to let us know until the new year what she's decided. What's your guess, Martin?
I think they're finding it difficult. Don't forget that the Lady Arbuthnot, who's her boss, her husband is a top MOD Tory politician person, and they make lots of money contracting to the MOD. So there's plenty of conflicts of interest here. I think the problem they're going to have here is that there is no basis in British law for this trial. There just isn't one. It's not even arguable. It shouldn't be occurring at all. And of course, in Spain, the private company which was employed by the CIA via Sheldon Adelson to spy on Assange is actually itself being prosecuted.
So
real courts are starting to get it taken interest.
Well, let's see if Westminster Magistrate is a real court or a corrupt, crooked court. We shall see. Assange, again, was talked about, and this little clip is with two people. One is James Goodale, and the other one is Daniel Ellsberg, we're going to hear from now, talking about the Assange case. Well, Daniel Ellsberg was involved in the Pentagon Papers, I believe, which is a whole load of leaked stuff in the United States. And as he points out, Martin, he's saying that he thought that this had set a precedent in the US, that nothing like what happened to him could happen to anyone, let alone Julian Assange in a foreign country.
Well, that's right. And he says that what he did, because he was a Pentagon insider, and this was in the days before modern technology, he carefully photocopied all of the internal files, which showed that the Pentagon leadership knew that they were losing the war in Vietnam, that it was unwinnable, but they were telling the public, you know, one more big push.
And Congress, of course.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the same sort of thing is going on with the security services here, surely. You know, MI5s, your MI6, the CIA are all cut from the same cloth, aren't they?
Indeed. And, of course, you know, the Ellsberg passed this stuff to the New York Times. They published it. And in the end, the government realised that they couldn't prosecute anybody, because the fact was that these were genuine files. There was nothing that was untrue in anything that anybody had said, and that ultimately it's their responsibility to protect their own secrets. And if you can't protect your own secrets, you can't punish people for telling secrets that you have been unable to protect.
There's the other point, of course, which is that the security services here in the UK and everywhere around the world, they will say, for example, before an important vote over a war or a controversial action of some kind in Parliament, Martin, they will give briefings to MPs, won't they? And those briefings, of course, are private.
Yeah, and of course, what happens is there's an incredible deference towards them, partly simply through people being dumb, but also because people are scared. And they go out of their way to make sure they've got information on everybody who's of any importance, so that if they start making a fuss, then they can be dealt with. That's what they do. They've always been doing
it. I noticed also that Jonathan Evans was promoted to be Director General of MI5 when he did the cover-up for MI5 of the 7/7 London bombings.
Well, that may, of course, he was, and of course they're now, as we know, we've heard in the first part of the show, the government are trying to, and it's probably going to pass with this Tory majority, they're going to pass a law that says that anything they do, however illegal, is justified as long as they think it's justified. Amazing.
A descent into tyranny of some sort, as was talked about earlier. Anyway, let's have a listen now to James Goodale and Daniel Ellsberg talking about the Assange case.
Everyone should understand that the government has been thirsting for over 50 years to bring this criminal action against those who are performing journalistic functions. 50 years ago, it tried to stop the Times from publication. Lawyers call that a civil case. It thereafter tried to bring a criminal case, very much like the Assange case, in which it was trying to show that Ellsberg conspired with the New York Times reporters to violate the criminal laws of the United States, namely the Espionage Act. Now, they gave up on that case. It disappeared. But now, 50 years later, it's reemerged. What the government wants to prove is that when a reporter tries to get a leak by talking to a leaker, he, as a leakee, can be criminally convicted of a conspiracy for talking to a source. So what's involved here is a criminalization of the basic journalistic function, which is a reporter asks a source for information and thereafter is able to publish it. If that source has classified information and is leaking it, the government is saying they both go to jail. I would say there is one other similarity with the Pentagon Papers case, which turned out to have a lot of hooey in it, which the government made to seem very important, but it wasn't. It was stuff that had already been published in the New York Times. The government does not have a case here, really, against Assange for publishing information that violates national security. The information informed the public he published. It did not damage national security. The government can show no damage to national security in this case, and indeed can show that no individual was damaged by this publication. So keep in mind, this is the other side of the Pentagon Papers case that was never decided, but the information that's involved in it is of no more importance in terms of damage to national security as it was in the first instance.
And the stakes here are such that if the United States can extradite and prosecute Julian Assange or someone like Julian Assange, a foreigner to the United States living abroad, who has revealed true information and true documents, then no journalist in the world wants to publish information like that provided by Chelsea Manning or Ed Snowden is safe from the prospects of life imprisonment in the United States. Thus, this directly affects the interests, not just of the reporters, but the interests they serve, which is the possibility of democracy in various places, which is threatened very much in this country right now. They want to close down, in other words, unauthorized disclosures, meaning that the news we have of what our government is doing in our name, with our tax money, and to other people in the world, is based entirely on government handouts, as it is in some places in the world, like I take it, China or Stalinist Russia, previous place, the end of a republic, essentially, of any kind of public sovereignty. Now, as I follow the tweets on this by Kevin Gostola and Joe Laurie of Consortium News, Craig Murray and some others, following it, I'm forced to relive a trial, my trial, that I had hoped not to have to think about ever again.
So that's Daniel Ellsberg, the leaker of the Pentagon Papers from, 50 years ago, Martin, saying that he'd hoped that this was all dealt with then, but it's all coming back to bite us.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is clearly a push towards a more authoritarian state, both in the US and Britain as an enabling power. But of course, it's actually completely at variance with British legal tradition going back centuries, which is why I'm astonished that we've got to this stage. This should have been thrown out at the very earliest stages, because there isn't any basis in British law, in English common law, for this prosecution.
Well, why didn't, do you think, Julian Assange do a deal with Donald Trump, for his freedom?
Well, the reason why Assange didn't do a deal for his freedom is because that would presume that he'd done something wrong, which he needed to be pardoned.
So he's a principled guy.
Yeah, he's a very principled guy. He certainly is.
And also, of course, as we heard a couple of weeks ago, he was prepared to kill himself with a razor blade rather than face life in prison and torture in the United States.
Yeah, although the psychologist brought in by the government to say that this was all phooey, turns out that his company works very closely with the Ministry of Defence on psychological warfare.
And they knew
the
facts.
Everybody to do with the case from the prosecution side have got massive links with the British military-industrial complex, and they all make money out of it.
Anyway, just about a week after he was taken to hospital with COVID, Donald Trump is out. So let's hear from him and Biden.
Don't let it dominate you. Don't be afraid of it. And now I'm better, and maybe I'm immune. I don't know. But don't let it dominate your lives. Get out there.
I would hope that the president, having gone through what he went through, and I'm glad he seems to be coming along pretty well, would communicate the right lesson to the American people. Masks matter. These masks, they matter. It matters. It saves lives. It prevents the spread of the disease.
So he's saying, get out there, Martin. He's taking a very different attitude to Biden, who's saying masks matter, whatever that means.
Well, I mean, it's become politicised, hasn't it, this whole response to
the
pandemic.
It's a bit silly, isn't it, really? We should be letting doctors decide these things, not politicians who've got an axe to grind.
Well, the politicians ultimately have to trade off the economy versus the medical side of it.
Should not be allowing people from the big pharma into positions like chief medical officer and chief scientific officer to make these decisions for the politicians.
Well, these people come to their positions through a process, Tony.
Called infiltration. That's exactly what the big pharmaceutical industry lobby does.
It's the same with the arms industry.
There's
far too much power for vested interests in the way we run our systems. I'm not denying that. On the other hand, the systems are still there. Maybe we shouldn't participate in elections at all, Tony. Maybe we should just start killing police officers and build a commune right here, right now, from people.
You want a world revolution?
Well, I'm just saying, if you're going to say we shouldn't have anything to do with the system, that's the logic where you're going.
I'm saying, basically, I mean, as you were saying a couple of weeks ago, that we should have a professional civil service that doesn't allow things like big pharmaceutical company presidents with £600,000 worth of shares making decisions.
Yes, can I also mention the group you talked about earlier, the Baratza group or whatever it's called? I sent you an article about this by Nafiz Ahmed.
Yeah, we've already said this.
Yes, but the point is that they have got an axe to grind as well. They've got lots of interest.
Martin, you've already said this. These axes to grind have got to be kept out of the system. And, of course, we can't scrutinise that if we've got this draconian form of journalism we'll be just hearing about Julian Assange being basically a scapegoat for.
Indeed, and therefore everybody's voice should be heard, but that doesn't mean that everybody's right or that everybody's got the answer. Okay, in actual fact, everybody is using the appeal to authority.
Yeah, and we heard Vernon Coleman giving you some very good examples of lots of voices that are not being heard. Anyway, we're off to Hong Kong now, and the COVID National Security and the link between COVID and the National Security Act is discussed this week with me by Robert Hansen, and the links between Hong Kong and China. What has been going on over there, I asked him.
anybody flying into Hong Kong has to do 14 days quarantine. So if you came to Hong Kong, Tony, you'd have to do 14 days quarantine. With a cabin crew, what they like to do is they like to get into Hong Kong and then get out of Hong Kong, maybe have one night in a hotel and then get back to the UK or onto their next journey. In this particular instance of the cabin crew, they normally stay at a very nice hotel, a high five-star super luxury hotel. And they were all checked into this hotel for one night and then back to London, hopefully the following day. But in the middle of the night, like 2-3 in the morning, all the medical staff came in with their medical gear, all their masks and all their blue rubber gloves and everything, and then said, one person's tested positive, so you've all now got to go into quarantine. So they were taken from their five-star super luxury hotel to a quarantine center where the room is about 8 feet by about 5 feet and very basic. And so this British Airways staff is not happy because she's young, she's healthy, and she's lost her five-star hotel. She can't go back to England, and she's just literally locked up for 14 days in Hong Kong. In Hong Kong now, after the security bill was put, the first thing, the security bill is called Article 23. Well, it should have gone. There's two ways to pass security law in Hong Kong. One, you can do it in the Hong Kong, the equivalent of the British Parliament, the Hong Kong Parliament, it's called LegCo, the Legislative Council. But they've tried to get that through originally in 2003, didn't get it through, so it was never passed in Hong Kong. The other way you can pass laws in Hong Kong, if mainland China passes the law in mainland China and then says, this belongs to security and you're having this law. And with the national security law, this law was passed in China and forced into Hong Kong and then just signed into law in Hong Kong. So there was no debate in the Hong Kong Parliament about it. It was just stamped, passed, you're having it. And essentially, you're not allowed to criticize the Communist Party in any way. You're not allowed to mention the word separation of Hong Kong from China. That's a breach of the national security law. And for that, you can face life imprisonment. That's how serious it is. If you call for anything to do with Hong Kong independence, Hong Kong separation, you're looking at a life sentence, which is not good. Okay. It's that serious. If you,
you were saying earlier on, you've got a couple of million people out on the streets all saying this last year. Now nobody.
Absolutely nobody. So there's two things about the protests. A, these are the kind of the discussions. Were they organised by external forces trying to disturb China, or was China itself organising the protests in order to justify passing the national security?
Well, I mean, there's another thing, and that is that there may just be genuine fear by ordinary Hong Kong people, and that may contribute to it too. So which, spread of who's behind them? Was it a genuine local movement? Was it the CIA spending money trying to agitate to annoy the Chinese, or the Chinese trying to agitate and control the opposition?
It could have been. I mean, this was a protest that was well organized and well funded. I mean, extremely well organized. And, very well funded. Leaflets, banners, all the electronic stuff as well. The way, if you're at the protest, a black van would arrive and it would give out free food for everybody. Really nice food as well. I just passed by a couple of these protests and observed these vans arriving and giving out, high-end Pret A Manger sandwiches and, nice water, nice pop, and to the protesters. So it was organized. It was definitely organized. That's the one thing that is sure about.
And what do you make of the actual virus itself?
I got a printout a while ago of the people that have died of the virus. Most of them are in their 90s, in their 100s. People live a long time in Hong Kong, and in their 80s. And I think there's very, very few under the age of 60 that have died with, not even from, but with this coronavirus in Hong Kong. So I don't think it's that serious. I don't know anyone that's actually had the virus. It seems to me that it's just one hell of a, it's going to be used really to just to control people. You think about what happened in Hong Kong. Was it the national security law that scared people, or was it the virus that scared people? Because they both kind of happened at the same time. Well, the virus came and then the security law was passed virtually at the same time. So the virus helped stop, you know, the protests, stop gathering. And it's been used as a legal excuse to say you can't gather in more than groups of four outside, therefore you can't protest. Very convenient for that. It's very convenient to start vaccinating people. It's very convenient to have a health passport, a digital passport, which I think is coming up 200 miles an hour.
So that's Robert Hansen speaking to me this week from Hong Kong, Martin. He's I found quite fascinating things he was saying there was all the money that seems to be being spent at these protests, like all the nice sandwiches and pop being brought for people, everything very no expense spared for the protests. Now nothing at all.
Well, I mean, the Chinese government has always claimed, and I think rightly, that the protesters are being manipulated by foreign intelligence services.
That's the Americans and the Brits, is it?
Yeah. And that doesn't mean that there aren't legitimate reasons for people to protest. That just means that, you know, my enemy's enemy is my friend. And we're going to hear something about the IRA in the First World War there. They were quite happy to take German rifles to fight the British. And, of course...
And by the way, the Israelis, in their very first days, 1947, 1948, were very happy to take Nazi Messerschmitts to have an air force.
Well, indeed. So, in other words, the both can be true. That there are genuine protesters who've got whatever their goals are, and you've also got outside forces egging them on because it causes trouble for the Chinese Communist Party. Just as the Chinese Communist Party, for example, supported the Zimbabwean African National Liberation Army in Zimbabwe many years ago because they wanted to, you know, basically mess with the West.
But I was quite interested to talk to Robert about, well, he was very much volunteering the information. Fascinating to hear about the Rockefellers and the secret societies that operate in Hong Kong and China.
One of the big players in China is the Rockefeller Institute, the Rockefeller Foundation. That's massive. It's been in China since the days of Chairman Mao, and even worked with Chairman Mao. And it's extremely influential in the financial sector, and it's extremely influential in promoting the global warming scam. Indeed, some of the Rockefeller family come across to Hong Kong to actually give talks on the global warming scam and have written children's books on it. So, yeah, the Rockefellers are extremely influential in China. Who's doing this? You know, my mind switches between the two. I'm not sure. Is it the mainland doing it on purpose to do this? Or is it America doing it? Or is it, you know, really what you've got is you've got this serious group of serious world leaders, the real people that run the world, who are... But some are Chinese, some are British, some are American, some are German, and they're the real controllers of the whole
interesting,
thing.
Isn't it? I mean, you've got secret societies, you know, the famous triads. I don't know if they're still around. But they're
still around, actually. There was a stabbing in a bar last night, a triad, and somebody was murdered. So the triads still exist in Hong Kong.
Because I'm thinking, because you've got the triads in China and Hong Kong, you've got the Masons over in the United States, and you've got people like Henry Kissinger.
The Masons are certainly very active in Hong Kong, and I know that for sure. And I know that, I know that is, and they're very heavily involved in the legal sector.
Okay, Robert Hansen again, Martin. Interesting that he's one of the fascinating things about Robert, I think he's got a similar perspective to me, is he's always trying to work out where the power actually lies. He's saying, well, he's not even sure that this is really a fight between China and the United States going on in Hong Kong, or China and Britain, that actually there's a third force, a bigger force, a more powerful force that is using Hong Kong just as a cat's paw.
Well, I mean, I have to say I'm basically a traditional international relations person, and I think that there is fundamental differences in the interests of different elites, and that they're not all in the same.
I don't think he's saying they're all in the same boat, but he's saying that there is a contingent of super elites, if you want, who actually like to play one side off against the other and find it rather entertaining and get power from it.
Well, Kissinger's a rapprochement with China in order to isolate the Soviet Union was the major power play by the US elites in the 1970s, just as taking the dollar off gold was part of the same Nixon administration strategy.
But you can't talk about Hong Kong and China without thinking about the massive influence that China has, say, for example, here, at the possibility of building the Hinkley Power Station and other things. We were talking to Ian Robinson earlier about the deep water port that is supposed to be being financed at Avonmouth by the Chinese. And he had some fascinating, I thought anyway, revelations about Chinese control and Hong Kong control of British utilities. Now, these are the things that were privatised by Margaret Thatcher back in the 1980s, the water, gas, electricity, telecoms, etc., the things that we all need to survive, the basic infrastructure of society, the things that we definitely need. And these are the kinds of people who don't actually, they're not entrepreneurs, they're just parasites. But anyway, he had quite an interesting angle on that because of what he thinks is an enormous amount of Chinese money involved in running British utilities right now. So why is it, I tell you, before we hear this, Martin, why is it we're hoo-haing about Huawei when actually the Chinese are owning many of our utilities?
Well, the fact is that the Chinese economy has become integrated into the global capitalist economy. Although, interestingly enough, what's happening now as a result of the recent events is that the Chinese are now moving towards looking at to boost their own domestic demand rather than being totally reliant on exports. And in actual fact, the Chinese economy is only about 15% dependent on exports. Most of what they do is actually within China itself.
Are the Western powers also thinking that, well, this financial interest that the Chinese have got in the West, maybe we'll just cut them off and maybe they'll get nothing back?
Well, indeed, they hold the US national debt. But they're mugs to hold the US national debt because the US have got no intention of paying it. So what they're now deciding is that they're going to have to develop their own resources because all the sanctions, which the WTO, in fact, have decided are unfair under the existing rules, they're now going to have to move to a more autarkic policy within China.
What does that mean? Autarky
is when you actually have a complete, you're like North Korea, where you run your own show your own way and you don't have any foreign influence. And of course the same thing happened with the sanctions on Russia after the Crimea incident. The Russians were then forced to actually redirect their resources to their own internal resources and to people who were more reliable for them. So both China and Russia.
It's a bit like Britain before exchange controls.
Yes, but they're much bigger. China and Russia are big enough, if they're pushed out of the mainstream system by the West, and that seems to be the way things are going.
What I'm trying to do is pull this down to talking about here in the UK, because it's all very easy to think about this and far away, but Britain was basically running its economy to benefit its own population up until exchange controls. Then all sorts of other companies could come in and buy up, as I'm just saying here, these Chinese utilities.
Well, the British economy was, as always, that we were the dominant hegemonic power until World War One. And at that, and that's how, we didn't just run the British economy to suit the British. We ran the British economy and everybody else's economy to suit the British.
Anyway, final clip from Robert Hanson here is about the influence of Hong Kong and Chinese utilities and a specific individual on the British utilities.
If you look at products now, they have to come with an energy rating certificate, EPC, energy performance certificate. Even if you want to sell a house, you've got to have an EPC. Every product is graded for something like A to G. And with a smart meter, you'll be able to tell, is this product an A, B, C, D, E, F, or G? And if it's not the right one, sorry, mate, you're going to have to change it. And if you're using too much, essentially, it gives the other people, the people who run the system, the power to control what's going on in your house. And I think that is fundamentally wrong.
Okay. To what evidence is there that Chinese banks and businesses are buying up British utilities then?
Okay. I just got a print out here of. In terms of the energy companies, we'll do energy and water, just do two very quickly. SGN is actually mainly owned by a company in Abu Dhabi, that's one there. Northern Gas Networks is Hong Kong, essentially owned by Lee Ka Sing. That's a Hong Kong company, but he's very close to China. Cadent Electricity is owned by Qatar Investment. Wales and West Utility is 100% owned by Hong Kong. That's Lee Ka Sing's Chern Kong Group. SP Energy is owned by a Spanish group. UKPN, again, is owned by or 40% in that is owned by Chern Kong again, and Northern Power Grid is owned by Berkshire Hathaway. That's
so what is, I mean, it does strike me as it's strange. What is the point in our telecom network being Huawei being removed from that when you've got these Chinese and Hong Kong owned companies controlling much of our utilities? Obviously, if they're owned, they control the shareholders, they control the board, that sort of thing, then they could just put their people in to run these places.
Which is what they will do. And the real power is with the people that own the company. I'll just give you a few more of those and come back to you. Cambridge Water, again, is owned by Lee Kar Sing from Hong Kong. Essex and Suffolk Water, again, is owned by Lee Kar Sing from Hong Kong. Northumbrian Water is owned by Lee Kar Sing from Hong Kong. And
okay, who is this guy? Lee Kar Sing.
Whoa. Lee Kar Sing is one of the wealthiest men in the world. There was an interesting article in the South China Morning Post about 5 years ago. I cut it out. I wanted the paper copy because I know it's going to be removed from the internet. And they published it twice. And it said this: Lee Kar Sing owned his fortune not due to his great entrepreneurial skills, but due to the close relationship he had with the mainland Chinese government, which gave him preferential land at preferential prices. And that is how he's made his fortune. So my point is that if the government or the mainland China is giving him all these special deals, they've got a control over this guy. He's the front man. He's the Bill Gates of the vaccine world. He's the front man of this. And through him and through Hong Kong, which is supposed to be the good guy, China's supposed to be the bad guy. I'm saying there ain't any difference, folks. Wake up. This guy's going and buying up all the utilities on behalf of China. And when you've got them one by one, bit by bit, you are in full control of the important things that people need, the really, really important things. We need electricity. We need water. We need gas. We need telecoms. And these are the things, the important things, that they're buying up and they are controlling.
Haven't we made a bit of a strategic mistake? Interesting to hear that our own Wales and West utilities owned by this guy, Lee Kar Sing, from Hong Kong, the guy who's actually based in Hong Kong, but actually his real loyalty is to mainland China. Haven't we rather messed up by handing all these essential public services over to China?
Well, we shouldn't have privatised them at all. That's the obvious point to make. And, of course, Lee Kar Sing was a big contributor to Conservative Party funds for many years, when Mark Thatcher was still persona grata, before he was convicted of trying to overthrow the government of Equatorial Guinea in South Africa. He boned up Lee Kar Sing and said, it's time to pay up for Mumsy. And Lee Kar Sing gave money to the Conservative Party.
It's almost like organised crime, isn't it? Look,
well, it is like organised crime.
Week,
it is organised crime,
this
isn't
week
it?
In the Telegraph, Three seizes on the 5G boom as mobile mast sale renews merger talk. The Hong Kong-owned firm is considering selling some of its mobile network infrastructure to raise billions of pounds as demand for 5G grows. The mobile operator Three exploring a sale of its masts in a bid to cash in on the shift to 5G networks. So this is Lee Kar Sing in the telecoms business. I imagine it's quite a Huawei kit in his mask, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point is, if you're going to integrate China into the global capitalist economy, which everybody thought would be a great idea, then inevitably they're going to end up owning stuff. And of course, what they've got in China is you can't own anything more than 49%. So anybody investing in China has to give a controlling stake to the Chinese partner, often local governments. Now, one of the pressure things that Trump is pushing them to do is to change that, so that, you know, you could have majority-owned Western businesses operating in China. The Chinese are, for very good reason, in my view, not very pleased to do that, but I think it's the sort of thing they're prepared to do to try and get a deal with the Americans over trade. But increasingly, there's a very good article about this on the Saker this week. The Chinese are concluding that there's no real deals to be done with the West, as the Russians have known for years, that ultimately they're going to have to face them down. And of course, the fact that what will happen is that the stuff that they control in this country will simply be seized. But of course, if that happens, all Apple's investments in China will be seized. So we'll have to see who wins in that
well,
game.
Well, that, I imagine, is going to be more of a step towards a shooting war of some sort.
Well, indeed, the shooting war has already started in certain parts of the world, in case anybody hadn't noticed.
Places like North Ossetia and Nagorno-Karabakh. We've got various tension points around the world.
Yeah.
Also, I think something you pointed out to me after the show last week, Martin, is about election observers as well. That, I think, is quite an important topic, isn't it? Because all the controversy over the Venezuela election and the Belarus elections, apparently they weren't the election observers that they normally are. They usually have people from the OECD or the UN observing these elections.
Not the UN. The UN have been prepared to send people. It's the EU that won't send election observers to the
election. I mean, surely if there were election observers, they could just say, well, that was okay. That
that's why they don't send them. Yeah, that's why that's why the OSCE.
So they don't want to know whether an election is actually
no. Because if you're going to claim that Maduro and Lukashenko have lost the election, the last thing you need is independent observers on the ground saying, "Well, hang on a minute, it looks like he's won."
So this is the OECD, the European Union, this time.
No, the OECD is actually not the OECD. It's the OSCE, the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe.
Ah, right. Okay. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, and they basically are the same. Similar things happen with the Organisation for Prevention of Chemical Weapons. They have been captured by Western interests. So what happened in the UN this week, the former head of the Operation for Organization for Prevention of Chemical Weapons said that what had happened at Douma, where there was supposedly a chemical weapons attack by the Syrian army, was a fraud, and that the investigators on the ground testified that it was actually carried out by the jihadis who were supported by the West, by MI6 and the CIA. So they were the ones who actually carried out the attack. But at the same time, the OPCW has been captured by, and the Russians are very clear about this, it's now been captured by the West, so that they then come out with fraudulent findings. And they've also come out with a fraudulent finding about Navalny, supposedly being poisoned by Novichok from a plastic water bottle, which didn't kill anybody else who touched it, extraordinarily enough. But anyway, leaving aside all of the illogicalities in that, we're moving to a situation where the West is, unless it can control international organisations like the International Criminal Court, the courts that deal with the law of the sea, Organisation for the Prevention of Chemical Warfare, the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe, they either control them or they sabotage them. And of course they're using both mechanisms to try and basically get their way. And of course the main target of all this manipulation is the population in their own countries, so that they go along with all of this.
Briefly looking at antiwar.com and back to Trump, Martin, he says he's going to be out of Afghanistan by Christmas. I think it's well worth watching everything that Trump is saying in this election campaign to do with his foreign policy. He made a big thing in his first election 5 years ago that he was going to pull out of these foreign wars. At least he certainly wasn't going to start any. So we need to make sure, I think, keep a quite close eye on Trump. If he doesn't say that this time, there's probably a war coming, isn't there?
Well, Trump can say that because he's trying to say what he thinks will get him re-elected. Whether he's got the power to do anything he wants to do is another matter, because he's not necessarily in charge. But let's not forget that he assassinated Soleimani at the beginning of the year, which nearly started World War III just on its own. That was an act of war.
Well, I think the Iranians made sure that that wasn't ever going to happen.
Well, what they did is they missiled the American base, and the Americans didn't dare punch back. But that came very, very close. If the Americans had punched back, we wouldn't be talking about COVID. We'd be talking about all this other stuff.
Now, so for Black History Month, always like to do something a bit different. Last year, I did something about the black legend, which is this whole idea that there was some sort of Halcyon thing going on in places like South America when Christianity arrived, which was just simply not true. This week, I thought we'd have a look at something much more up to date, which is in the 1960s and 1970s, the planning policy in US cities after the American economy started to tank and they realised that there wasn't going to be income for these cities. They decided to change the way they do things. I think we've seen something similar going on in this country, Martin, where basically the local authorities are not satisfied with people on low incomes paying small amounts of rent, even for public housing. They want to make sure that large amounts of money in that city is being paid for rent so they can take their cut. Do you think that's been going on over here too?
Well, gentrification is and the manipulation of property markets has been going on for a very long time. But of course, as you know, after the Second World War in this country, you could have areas of London, for example, where council housing was cheap by jowl with relatively prosperous private housing.
But the actual amount was
using the planning laws to create mixed communities.
The amount of people were paying on rent was absolutely, you know, very, very, very low compared to their annual salary compared to today. And that's what really this clip is about. The guy giving the talk here is Lyndon LaRouche, who died last year. Do you want to say something about him? Because he's quite a controversial character, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a controversial character. He claims to be part of the Democratic Party tradition, although they've always disowned him. He's got quite radical views about various things, but he did
before he died.
You better hear what he's got to say. Sometimes he talks sense, and sometimes he's away with the fairies.
Let's have a listen to Lyndon LaRouche here talking about the Negro removal program in Boston and elsewhere in the United States in the 1960s and 70s.
When the United States was transformed from an industrial economy to a post-industrial economy. In the middle of the 1966-68 period, everything began to be turned around. As you know from many of you who are close to my generation and some younger, know that there was a change in the U.S. economy where suddenly everything began to go bad. We began to become a post-industrial society, and there was no flow of investment or a constricted flow of investment into anything that resembled real production, particularly from 1973-74, investment in productive industry, energy-intensive forms, capital-intensive forms dried out. Businesses, industries began to collapse. Employment began to collapse. The whole business. And then after the effect of deregulation of transportation in 1978, and then the Folkman measure 79 through 1982-83 especially, the entire economy went dead. Now, what happened is then you find an immediate collapse of the tax revenue base of state and local government. So now you have a city like Boston, and you say, okay, where are you going to get the money to meet the tax rolls for the city of Boston and for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? Because the industries like the Quincy shipyards, the Navy Yard down there in Charlestown Navy Yard and so forth, all these industries, GE used to have 30,000 employees in the area, they went down to who knows what, whole industries disappeared. Where's the tax revenue base? 128 began to shrink. Where's the tax revenue base? Well, what the city of Boston said, what the bankers said, the big insurance cartels that controlled Massachusetts, said to an organization called the Vault, which is operating on State Street, which involved the investment in government and other swindles by this crowd. They said, okay, the municipality of Boston, Greater Boston, has so many square miles of territory. Now, therefore, for Boston to get a tax revenue base, maintain it, we must get so many dollars in tax revenue per square foot of area. Now, we have no industries to get it from. We don't have any productive employment. So what do we have to do? We have to pull a real estate swindle. All right. We have to get real estate people to invest, increase the tax rate by giving them tax exemptions to get the gross tax base increased. Now that means we've got to swindle the people. Mm-hmm. So what you do where people have a $30,000 investment or a $40,000 investment represented in a home they may own or the equivalent apartment, kick them out. Gentrify the apartment. That started back in the 1960s with the older people in Boston. There were older people, semi-retired, who had fairly large family-style homes. They were kicked out and they began moving college kids in. You know, 20 to the room, right? At high rents. So they began to kick out the traditional residents of neighborhoods and do this. Then they went to real estate speculation. And Nancy Spanos knows a good deal about that sort of stuff because she and her later husband did a lot of work in New York on this study, right? So what they did then is they would say, okay, we'll let the real estate sharks steal so much and we'll take a small percentage of it. So the entire federal, state, local housing policy of government of the country was steered in this direction. This became a policy known as Negro removal. Right. Kick people out of the community, throw them into a worse slum, throw them out of the slums, and throw them into the countryside. That's how we got the big homeless problem in many of our cities.
Well, that's not a bad summary of what happened with the decisions that were made in that era to get from what was an industrial economy with strong trade unions and government intervention to ensure level playing fields in things like housing to where we are now, where, you know, we're building the massive monstrosity near Castle Park in Bristol, which no local person will be able to afford any kind of flat in there. They'll all be people from abroad who are basically money laundering. I bet it'll be very interesting to see how many people actually live there and are registered to pay council tax. Because in some of these big apartment blocks in London that have been built, mostly for foreigners, hardly anybody is registered there for council.
But it's
tax.
An interesting angle, isn't it, on the relationship between developers and government, in that actually this is good for the developers and it's good for the government. The developers make a load of money. The government, local government or national government, increase their tax revenue by gentrification.
No, what actually happens is they get a small cut of the swindle, as he pointed out.
Okay.
If they got more of a cut, then there might be a justification for it. You say, right, we're going to build these luxury homes, but we're going to tax them a lot so that we can afford to pay
and
the social services.
And that was Linda LaRouche.
But that isn't the case of what they've done.
That was Linda LaRouche.
It's just swindle, pure and simple.
From the LaRouche organisation who died last year. They're still around, though. I think it's called Executive Intelligence Review, their regular publication. And so our penultimate item tonight, Martin, is about the IRA and American help for them. Another LaRouche person here. And this, I believe, is Anton Chaykin talking about the early days of the IRA and the help that the Irish had in overthrowing the British Empire from the States. A chap called Henry Carey and Horton Barker and Arthur Griffiths.
Another person you never heard of, Horton Barker. He was a central figure in the project from here on out. This is a Carey insider in Philadelphia. It was at his house that the dignitaries from these other countries met when they came to the centennial. And just like they might come into Leesburg today, all right, to talk about what they're going to do. In 1878, he was hired by the Russian Tsar to build ships for the Russian Navy in the Philadelphia shipyard, warships. He then went to South Russia to supervise the industrialization of South Russia, or to plan that, with Bethlehem Steel, which was owned by his uncle, Joseph Warden. He also supervised the Ireland Revolution unit of the Carey people. That is, Irish people in America and Ireland, working together with this little circle of people, set up something called the Clan na Gael. And one of their central people went from Philadelphia to Ireland in 1878 and organized 20,000 feuding Irishmen into a central revolutionary organization called the Irish Revolutionary Brotherhood. And together with their Clan na Gael in the United States, which shipped arms and money to Ireland, that continued to be the main organization of Irish nationalism until Michael Collins and Arthur Griffiths, who worked for that organization, established the nation of Ireland right after World War I.
Well, Martin, it's interesting, isn't it, that the Americans were shipping over the arms for the Irish to kick the British out at the time of the First World War.
Well, it's well known that the Irish connection with America goes back to the famine and before. And of course, you know, it's still got valency, of course, in things like the Brexit talks with the congressional caucuses of both the Republicans and the Democrats saying any deal they do will have to be consistent with the Good Friday Agreement.
So who were these Clan na Gael people?
Clan na Gael was set up in the 19th century because, of course, the Fenians organised an uprising in the 1860s. That failed. Lots of them fled to the United States. Some of them were transported to Australia. And in the United States, they generally tended to be supporters of the Union, so they fought on the Union side. There was an attempted invasion of Canada from the United States by Irish Republicans who were based in the US after the American Civil War. It didn't get very far. And of course, it wasn't the Irish Revolutionary Brotherhood, it was the Irish Republican Brotherhood. It was called the IRB, which both Collins and Griffiths were part of. And of course, that led to the founding of the IRA, which then led the uprising in 1916.
I mean, they were fleeing to the United States from Ireland, but actually, there were a lot of people forced out during the famines to the US at the same time.
Yeah, that was earlier. That was in the 1840s. We're talking about the 1860s with the Fenian Uprising. And that was basically, you know, a dry run for what subsequently happened. In the 1900s.
Okay, well, we'll skip over Mazzini and Gaddafi. We'll have some from them next week. Both fascinating little interviews, but we'll do that next week. We'll finish this week with David Icke, Martin. Now, you know, some would say he's dodgy and dangerous. I've kind of changed my view about David Icke. I think he's particularly pernicious. Rather than sort of congratulating him for, you know, the idea of him having free speech, and of course I do still agree with him having the right to discredit himself whenever he wishes. For example, he said, and we had it on this program back in April, beginning of April, that he's actually said that he doesn't, well, he's not saying that he doesn't believe COVID-19, he's stating it as a fact. There is no COVID-19. COVID-19 doesn't exist.
Well, he's not noted for the temperance of his views. And everybody's entitled to their views, whatever they are, but of course they've also got to be able to justify them. And ultimately, of course, if you can't, then you can't.
And this is a little clip from a documentary by Chris White called David Icke Debunked, which I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I found it quite strange. I put into David Icke Debunked into the YouTube search. This video didn't come up at all for some reason. And I put it into another search engine's video search, and up it came straight away on YouTube. So YouTube doesn't seem to want to find this unless it's my account, which is massaged in that way. Who knows? But anyway, they're up to no good. They're certainly trying to stop people from seeing this stuff over at Google. But anyway, here is Chris White's, a clip from Chris White's documentary where he cites a guy called Ivan Fraser, who worked up until 1999 very closely with Icke himself, and then realised that Icke was actually stealing stuff and plagiarising material, particularly from this guy in this book, The Biggest Secret, from 99, from a guy called Brian Desborough. So here is a bit of Ivan Fraser's story of his encounter with Icke, working closely with Icke in 99, as told by Chris White.
Icke's book, The Biggest Secret, is the first time that I know of that Icke mentions Desborough in print. He dedicated that particular book to him, and he cites him profusely throughout the book as his source for things like Martians coming to Earth and founding the Aryan race, which the reptilians used to overtake the planet. Brian is also the source for much of the information on the Babylonian world, and things like black people are a result of the earth being closer to the sun at one point, the ice age being an illusion, monoatomic gold, directed energy weapons, UFOs are government craft, crop circles are space beams, David's new view on Jesus, and much more. Ivan Fraser, the other person who David dedicated his book, The Biggest Secret, to, later spoke out against David and said this about Brian Desborough, quote, "Is there anything David could tell us about Brian Desborough's background to allay any doubts we may have about his integrity, considering his massive influence in the content and direction of The Biggest Secret? Also, Icke's subsequent book called Alice in Wonderland and the World Trade Center Disaster is no better than a copy and pasting of Brian Desborough's article entitled The 9/11 Disaster, The Myth and Reality. If you have read Icke's Alice in Wonderland book on 9/11, please read Desborough's article when you have time, and you will see that the information in there is exactly the same, the wording, even the mistakes. But the curious thing is that even though it's clear from reading Desborough's 9/11 article that Desborough is the one who did all the research, Icke doesn't cite Desborough one time in his book, even though it's painfully obvious that it was taken from him. I think that Desborough was quite content to feed information to Icke, even if he got no credit. One example of this is in regard to the reptilian scandal. As I mentioned, The Biggest Secret is dedicated to Brian Desborough and another man named Ivan Fraser. According to Fraser, it was Desborough that introduced Icke to Arizona Wilder, and it was her testimony that ended up being the reason why Icke went public with the reptilians thing. Desborough also admits to introducing Ike to Arizona Wilder, as well as arranging the meeting between the two, because Wilder was a victim of trauma-based mind control, and apparently Desborough had accessed her programming in order to get information about the Illuminati. According to him, he was amazed to find that she confirmed what he had already been telling Ike, which will be important later. This is Ivan Fraser's side of the story. He had been proofreading The Biggest Secret for David Icke, and he found out about the reptilians thing this way. He says, quote, "Arizona Wilder was not mentioned at all in the draft copy of The Biggest Secret, which I had read. David had not met her yet. When the book was released, people started ringing me with questions like, 'Is it true about the reptiles?' and 'Is this stuff about the royal family true?' At which time I replied that I thought it was, based on the fact that the version that I had read stated only the theory of reptilians and that certain of the royals were involved in satanic rituals. Soon, I heard about Arizona Wilder. David stated that he saw his encounter with Arizona Wilder as an amazing synchronicity which endorsed his work in his latest book. How could she have known all this stuff which tallied so exactly with The Biggest Secret? Well, I believe I'm not as naive as David, and I know exactly how she could have known. Ike was passing copies of the book via post to me and others for editing." Fraser continues, "This brings in another character who is pivotal to the entire Biggest Secret thesis. It was a contact of David's named Brian Desborough, who introduced Arizona to David. Brian is mentioned as a source for a great deal of the information in the book, having supplied most of the material on which David based his idea about the Martians coming to Earth and founding the Aryan race, which the reptilians use as a vehicle to overtake the planet. Brian is also the source for much of the information David had compiled on the Babylonian world, its myths, and how they fed into the sinister secret societies. It was Brian Desborough who was also looking at the draft copy of The Biggest Secret at the same time as myself, i.e. before David met Arizona Wilder. Therefore, the fact that Brian Desborough may be responsible for fundamentally leading the direction of David's research, if not planting much of the basis of the book in David's mind, is obvious. But then, to be the same person responsible for giving him the so-called eyewitness to testify to the verity of that information is highly suspicious. Brian also writes articles on mind control and seems very knowledgeable on the subject. Is it possible that he could be directly involved in some way that we are not being told about?" Fraser also says that Arizona endorsed Desborough's theories so closely that, quote, "you would almost think she had already read the book or had been given the information beforehand."
So that was Chris White there as part of his David Icke debunked documentary, which is about 2.5 hours long. I think we'll spare you most of that. But I'll put a link up for anyone that's interested on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I suppose the long and short of the documentary, Martin, is that various of his so-called friends are playing David Icke like a fiddle.
Well, it sounds to me as if they're arguing about who actually exposed the reptilian Martian conspiracy. And Ike claims that he thought of it first. And this guy seems to claim, no, I thought of it first, or Brian Desborough thought of it first. But since what I actually fear about all of these is, as a political conspiracy theorist, we want to talk about 9/11, then we'd have to talk about Piazza Fontana. We have to talk about the IRA and Glenn Nagel and things like that.
Well, he's talking there about Ike's 9/11 book, yes, which is Alice in Wonderland.
Well, but the problem with all of this is it then makes everybody think that when we talk about 9/11, we're talking about aliens and Martians.
Well, that's absolute nonsense.
No, of course
it is.
That's
why we're talking about
it. And it may well be that Ike and others like him are actually controlled opposition to make it impossible for us to talk seriously about serious political conspiracies like blowing up the Twin Towers, which wasn't done by Martians, it was done by the US security forces. And of course, just like Clan na Gael or the Irish Republican Brotherhood, maybe we need to talk about weaponry to fight them rather than publishing books and arguing about a lot of nonsense.
Well, you're right, it is nonsense. I am rather interested in what's happened to Ivan Fraser, though. I certainly see he was on the John Ronson programme, I think it was around 1999, and he was particularly astute as someone who was working closely with Ike and then decided to turn against Ike, turn the tables on him and expose him. But he seems to have disappeared off the face of the earth, Martin.
Listen, I wonder whether all of these people who
Ivan, I think, was a very honest guy who thought that there were some positive things about what Ike was doing. Then he discovered the deception.
I'm willing to listen to anybody's point of view, but my point of view is the point of view that counter gangs are created as a normal part of psychological warfare, as we read in Kitson, gangs and counter gangs, written after the Kenyan emergency in the 1950s.
One of the main thrusts.
So one of the things the state does is create false narratives of conspiracy, so that when we actually start talking seriously about serious conspiracies, the normal population are inoculated against listening to it, because they've basically been told all sorts of nonsense about it by people who are possibly paid agents of the state.
The author of Secrets and Lies and the History of Organized Crime, David Southwell, tweeted controlled opposition about David Icke.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think people can be controlled opposition even if they think they're being genuine. But some people aren't even thinking they're being genuine. They're genuinely controlled opposition.
What do you make of the allusions in, I mean, throughout that documentary, he's talking about David Icke being a closet theosophist, following the teachings of Alice Bailey, doing things like saying, well, the Earth is going to be transformed by these beams of light from the centre of the solar system, which are reflected through the sun onto the Earth, this sort of thing.
Yeah, well, the purpose of all of this is that when you and I, for example, start talking about Clan na Gael, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, blowing things up, the Dublin and Monaghan bombs of 1972, and the role of the Ghanaian gang, for example, to say, but you just believe that aliens did it all. And they, of course, we don't believe that, but they do. So they put 9/11 in there, which is a serious conspiracy, and then they put all this other stuff in as well. And at one stage in the 9/11 truth movement, I used to be a hippie. I'm perfectly happy to chat about all sorts of weird and wonderful ideas. But there's a big distinction between having a stoned conversation after dinner and organising an armed revolution.
I suppose it's all
not the same thing at all.
It's all to do with the difference between fact and speculation, something that we try and separate as much as possible here. Time to sign off. Thanks to our guest, Martin Summers, Irish Republican Labour activist. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s. You can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. It's also on my Public Inquiry YouTube channel. If you want to comment, you can do as well as you can on thisweek.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Shake my paranoia, can't stop the rock. Shake my paranoia, can't stop the rock. to the groovy.
Down and dirty, baby.